go.
Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Well, a very happy Memorial Day weekend to you all. Welcome to the Friday edition of Head On. I'm Bob Kincaid, of course. Not likely to tune into this program and get anybody besides me. I hope you all have a wonderful, wonderful Memorial Day weekend. And I hope you will spend some of the time that is given as a long weekend remembering the purpose of the holiday and those who have gone before and given so very much, even in the face of what it's been turned into, this nation, given so much to bring us to this point. With that being said, we've got a very busy little night ahead of us. Coming up in about an hour, we'll be talking with Cindy Sheehan about her contest in California, her attempt, her bid to unseat Nancy Capitolosi. But right now, it's Friday, and if it's Friday, that means it's time for our weekly conversation with Carolyn Kay, all the way from Chicago, and MakeThemAccountable.com. Hey, Caro, welcome aboard. Good to talk to you.
Hi, Bob. Good to be here. Capitolosi. Oh, I like that.
Oh, do you? Do you?
Yes.
Well, you know,
I had not heard that before.
Well, it's my very own.
Oh, it's excellent.
So I sit around here just, you know, trying to come up with stuff, and sometimes people send things to me as well, and that's I like Capitolosi. It just fits, doesn't it? It kind of works with the whole rubber spine thing.
Yeah.
I wanted to start off by saying, you know, I think we can put one in the win column. We've actually made John McCain run away from Pastor Hagee and Pastor Parsley.
Yeah, that's something, huh?
Well, it really is. Nobody ever was able to make George Bush run away from those freaks. But through a combined tsunami, if you will, of backlash against these hate mongers, we've actually succeeded in making him at least put on the dog and pony show of so-called repudiation.
Yeah.
And you got to feel good about that, don't you?
Well, I wonder about these people for getting involved with some of these folks to begin with. That is my question. It's not as though he hasn't had presidential ambitions for a very, 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 very long time, and it's not as though he doesn't have a staff.
And it's not like they don't know how to use the Google.
Yeah, right.
Well, but then again, you got to cut McCain's staff a little bit of a break, Caro, because after all, they've been awfully busy running around advocating on behalf of the junta in Myanmar and the Jonas Savimbi, and for all I know, North Korea and the Hitler Youth. They may not have had time to really fully vet a guy who practically every breath that comes out of his mouth is either the great whore of Babylon, the Roman Catholic Church, or Hitler was a hunter sent to drive the Jews to the Holy Land. I mean, how much can they be expected to do, really?
Well, I would expect that they would be looking at some of these people that say, oh, I want to endorse John McCain. What have you said bad about anybody?
that's the funniest thing, though, Caro. Neither of these guys approached John McCain.
He approached them.
He chased them like a puppy after a pork chop bone.
Mm.
I mean, you know, he went on attack, did the tawdry little thing about, well, I never sat in Pastor Hagee's church for 20 years. No, he did something worse. He chased him for purely cynical political gain.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the one downside to all of this is that, as I noted, you know, Hagee, you know, climbed, you know, if, you know, Hagee just looked at us and said, you know, if you guys are going to be down on the veranda smoking a cigarette, I'm climbing up on the cross. And he did, in the repudiation thing, and basically telling him, you know, telling his mouth breathing, knuckle walking faithful that he was having to do this because he was another Christian being persecuted by the liberals. So I wonder if this is going to have any effect. I'm hoping it'll have a...
I don't think so. See, to have any effect, it has to hit the interest bone of the punditry, okay? And I assure you, they are so in love with... You talk about the thrill up the leg or whatever it is that they have for McCain. None of this will go anywhere. Or they'll make excuses, or, you know, just as in my opinion, they've done in a lot of instances for Barack Obama.
But, you know, Tweety Matthews and Timmy are both self-professed, very much avowed Roman Catholics. How can they just let this one fly by, considering what Hagee has said?
No, if you're making $5 million a year, and you know that the continuation of that amount of money depends on your keeping your trap shut about certain things. I think most people keep their trap shut about those certain things.
Do you think at the highest levels of punditry? God, I hate pundits and pundits. I wonder what does that mean in the original Indian language where it comes from, a pundit?
I don't know.
Because I think it is of Hindu origins. But do you think that they're really nervous that Democrats might actually try to do something about media if we get, say, a solid majority in both houses of Congress and the presidency?
Well, there are those who believe that the main reason why the media trashed Al Gore so badly and made a saint out of George Bush in the 2000 election was that Al Gore stated unequivocally that he was going to stop all this media consolidation. Boom. That was it.
and that was before it had really, really gotten itself untracked and gone completely hog wild, wasn't it? I mean, it wasn't consolidated to the level it is today. I interviewed a guy from the Center for American Progress, I guess about a year ago, who when I finally, I just put the question to him flatly, I said, are we talking about issues in terms of making things better, are we talking about issues of divestiture? And he said, we absolutely are.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think the Congress could actually find the nerve, you know, I mentioned the rubber spine a little bit ago, to do to the media conglomerates what we did to AT&T back in the day? In other words, divest them?
Oh, and make them divest? Oh, I don't know. I don't know if they would go that far. Heck, we can't even get them to really stop funding the damn war, you know. I don't know. I don't think they would go that far. Not until we get serious, serious reform in the whole process and reduction of the ability to buy politicians and so on. I have this, the definition of pundit, by the way.
Oh.
A learned person. It comes from Hindu, which I did not know, so I'm glad you told me that. Variant of pandit, P-A-N-D-I-T. And the Hindi pundit is a learned man from the Sanskrit pandita, learned scholar.
Well, then I think it's safe to say that
Dravidian origin. I bet you didn't know that.
Dravidian?
Dravidian.
Oh, my God. well, wonderful work there. And I think it's safe to say that we can stop, based on that definition, Caro, we never, ever, ever have to refer to Tim A. or Tweety
as a pundit because it means learned.
Right. Because we're talking about people who you know, stare at their shoelaces like a cow looking at a new gate in the every morning.
Well, they are learned about their opinions of their own little circle. Okay, they're very learned about that, and they never, ever stray from that little reservation. You know, that is their area of expertise, and they are able to spout it endlessly without ever any thought. So perhaps the scholar part doesn't fit. You know what really surprises me about this whole thing? I mean, you know, when I was growing up and in college and, you know, young working person and all of that, this business of liberal and conservative just didn't, it wasn't there, you know, and there wasn't this, this absolute, you know, push for a certain ideology or anything like that. So as I started to learn about the process, about what was going on, when I got so concerned in 2000 about the differential treatment of Al Gore and George Bush, and that was when I first got really involved in politics for the first time in my life, one of the things I read was, so-and-so is a conservative scholar. And I went, a what? I thought a scholar was a person who sought answers to questions based on the facts.
Or based on the...
go wherever the facts would lead them.
Yeah, on a generalized desire to increase knowledge.
Yeah.
Not to increase conservative knowledge. Well, that's like saying you're a liberal biologist.
Exactly. Or a conservative physicist.
But that's what's happened to America, Caro, because last night on the Horn section, I was talking with John Fox a little bit about this, these statistical numbers that came out that were just horrifying. What it boils, the biology teachers across the country were surveyed, and 16% of the biology, high school biology teachers, 16% of them say that the Earth is less than 10,000 years old and that God made human beings pretty much in their current form and that evolution is a big old dirty lie.
Oh, my God.
Those are biology teachers, Caro.
Oh, my God.
So I guess they would qualify as a conservative biology scholar.
Oh, my God.
So that's the transformation. You know, what you saw at the beginning and what it's transformed into has been a continuum. It's interesting you would bring up, you know, former decades, former days, by virtue of the fact that my father was a member, and even though he's gone on now, we still get the Journal of the American Association of Retired Persons here. And I just got done reading the June issue, and they've got this big, long timeline on 1968, you know, 40 years ago. And the earth-shattering stuff that happened during that particular year, and one of the things that they quote people talking about how their lives changed, and the classic example of so-called conservatism, you know, I was 5 years old. I think you've probably got a little bit better memory of 1968 than I do. But one of the people that was quoted was Michael Medved. Now, you're aware of...
Michael Medved was quoted from 1968?
Well, he was quoted talking about his experiences in 1968. I probably didn't frame that well enough. But, you know, he was a young man then, and he said... And, you know, here's all the upheaval going on in the country. Michael Medved said he walked into a diner in Virginia, and there were some African-American men talking to a white waitress, and no one was glaring at each other, so he decided that racism didn't exist in America anymore.
It's sort of like Bill O'Reilly going to Sylvia's in Harlem and saying that people were just eating like ordinary people.
and nobody was hollering, "Bring me more tea, you MF-er." Wasn't that what O'Reilly said?
Nobody was throwing things. Nobody was pulling guns.
But this stuff really does exist on a continuum, doesn't it? It begins with these little seeds and it grows into these noxious weeds. I mean, Michael Medved. Not seeing a riot take place in a diner in the middle of the night in Virginia creates the myth that there's no, you know, and he doesn't have to confront the facts anymore. He's reached a conclusion, and I think maybe that's the definition of liberal or conservative scholar that we're talking about. What you described is a person who does not apply the scientific method of inquiry to anything. He merely forms an opinion and then cherry picks information to support it. I mean, isn't that certainly
what has been going on in all of these so-called think tanks. I call them stink tanks. where, you know, everything is cherry-picked in order to reach the conclusions that one wants to reach. I have to tell you about a cartoon that Krugman posted about a week or so ago. It's from the New Yorker. He says, "I do like everyone else. I read the cartoons first."
Oh, sure.
But it's of two men in a desert. You know, they're on their knees. They're dragging. They're, you know, they have no they apparently have no water and no way to go. Oh, shoot, now I can't find it. Where is it? But anyway, they're obviously out of water. They're dying, and then they say, one of them says, "Here it is." One of them says to the other one, he says, "Rescue be damned. Our conservative principles will see us through." And that's the way I think of these people, is that, you know, nothing deters them. No facts ever get in the way. Nothing ever changes their minds. And that was not what I learned growing up. What I learned was, you think you know something and you state an opinion and somebody else says, "Well, no, I think I have there's this to consider," and then you talk about that and you can change your mind. You know, you can say, "Oh, I see your point, and you know, let's go beyond that and let's, you know, move on to this and whatever and whatever." But not this total wall of, "This is what I believe. I will never change that belief, and anything else is being wishy-washy and coddling and giving in." And I had never run into that until the right wing started to have, you know, such ascendancy here in this country. It's insane.
Well, it truly is, and it's something that has to be battled back, I think. When you see numbers like what I pointed out with the biology teachers, you know, 16% of them say espouse the young Earth 10,000 years old or less, but 47% of them say that that while they don't believe the Earth is less than 10,000 years old, they believe that, you know, God has driven the entire process and that, you know, evolution's kind of a scam.
You know what's really interesting about that is that if you really delve into science, and yeah, I have, not as a scholar, conservative, liberal, or otherwise, but as an outsider, and I have read, you know, some of the books about the Big Bang and the and quantum theory as much as, you know, a non technical person can really understand, and all of that. And I find it so fascinating, because if you think about the intricacies of the derivation of the universe and the, you know, the smallest subdivisions of matter and energy as we know them right now, to think that, you know, you could believe that all of that was created by, you know, some superior being. And if so, that is a whole lot more fascinating than believing that your Earth disappeared one day, you know, with animals and everything all intact. To me, it's much more fascinating to think of it as, you know, over such a long period of evolving and creating and becoming. And, you know, if those first building blocks were created, knowing how they would all turn out, or maybe not knowing, or just saying, you know, let's set this thing in motion, see what the hell happens, you know?
And that, you know, that runs along the lines of Aristotle's prime mover,
yes,
who sort of flips the marble, but then stands outside of the circle where the marble,
yeah,
is traveling and can't do anything more.
Yeah.
And I think for people like the founders of our nation, the framers of our Constitution, that was a lot easier for them to swallow. But that doesn't change the fact that the right wing will just make it up as they go along, Caro.
That's right.
And the next thing you know, your kid's walking in the door coming home from 10th grade biology explaining to you that, you know, miracles make frogs. that frogs don't come from tadpoles. They spring fully formed from the head of the previous frog or something like that. That's a terrible thing to do to a kid's mind, but b to America's future.
Mm-hmm.
We constantly see these studies, and in fact, right wingers love to point to them because right wingers hate our education system and they hate public education, and they love to say
they want a kind of education system where kids grow up totally ignorant of anything but their ideology, and that they grow up as little goose-stepping right-wing voters.
Yeah, dumb and scared. That should be the motto. Maybe we could translate it into Latin or something, but dumb and scared should be the motto of right-wing education policy.
Exactly. Exactly.
But they constantly, America's lagging behind, blah, 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 we're getting... And they point that stuff out as a reason to, stop having public education, that we're not keeping up with the rest of the world. But then they fail to realize that the reason we're not keeping up with the rest of the world is the rest of the world isn't teaching fundamentalist biology or conservative calculus.
They're teaching the real biology and the real science, and they're getting way ahead of us in terms of discoveries and so on. The fact that people can't see this, I just don't understand.
Well, they can't see it because I'm about to be an elitist. They can't see it because of things like American Idol. We got an American Idol winner a couple of nights ago. And everybody, with possibly the exception of me and you, knows who the two contestants were. I just know they were named David, both
yeah.
of them.
I knew because I watched. This was the first season where I started watching it, and there was a contestant that I thought was really superb and very sexy, and that's probably the reason why he, crapped out early.
Oh, Caro, no, not you two. Please tell me no.
Well,
they put
what?
The pod under your bed.
No, I quit watching because I didn't believe that the thing could be legit. That the people who my guy Michael Johns got voted out early on and supposedly voted out, and I just said I don't believe this, so I quit watching it. I'll never watch it again. I do watch some of the other contest shows, the ones where you have to have a real skill. I like Top Chef and Project Runway. And I even like Tyra Banks' show, America's Next Top Model. Call me crazy, but I like it.
Oh, I'll pray for you, Caro. I'll pray for you.
Well, here's the thing. To me, those kinds of shows where it's real experts doing the choosing, and doing the judging mm-hmm. and the choosing.
I've heard good things about Top Chef, I just don't think I don't get the channel that it comes on.
You don't get Bravo?
No.
Oh,
no.
Okay.
No.
Our
cable system consists of two rusty dented tin cans and a string. So.
Okay.
Every now and then, I turn it on, and there's a very young David Brinkley on the channel. So.
It's
rolling in 30 years later.
It's an echo from another world, from the past.
Yeah, 45 years out in space, and it comes down to me.
Comes back. The thing about those shows, and I thought American Idol was one until I, said no, this can't be. The really talented people or get voted off first. To me, it's a kind of democratization of certain aspects. I mean, think about Project Runway was the first one that I started watching. And as I began to see what was happening, what was going on, I said, in what circumstance would these young people ever be able to show the world what they were doing and what they were creating, except in this kind of environment? So this sort of bypasses the traditional means of, like in the case of acting, the casting couch approach to choosing stars, and things like that. It takes the control out of the hands of the very few who claim to know everything, the be all and the end all. And so it's very similar to in the film industry, independent films finding a way to the public, and now through the internet and so on. And I like that. I like the idea that somebody with talent can bypass the usual structures that try to control everything.
Well, I can see the argument there. Now, speaking of television, there is some viewing worth doing. Oh, aren't I clever? viewing worth doing this weekend. If I had HBO, I would be huddled around the TV long about Sunday for a look at a watch of Recount.
Recount, yeah.
Yeah. Are you planning on taking that in?
Well, I don't have HBO. I don't have any of the premiums.
Oh, me either.
I refuse to pay extra. I'm already paying through the nose, I feel, you know, just for the basic stuff. So,
wait till somebody sneaks it up onto YouTube in segment form and watch it really quickly. Yeah.
Sure. Why should I pay for it?
I mean, I saw that segment that Olbermann did with Kevin Spacey, and I have so much respect for the work that Kevin Spacey does. And they played the clip of Dennis Leary explaining to him that the plural of Chad is Chad. And I have a feeling,
okay.
I have a feeling that they have done a brilliant job with the script.
It is not either, because I have right in front of me, I bought some Chads when I was in Florida right after the 2000 election.
No, you didn't.
I did too. I don't think I bought them. I think Walt bought them for me and gave them to me. His official Florida souvenir, 2000 presidential election, Florida ballot, Gore versus Bush, Chads. And then there are these little pieces, these little rectangles of...
punch cards.
Of punch cards, right.
But they cast Laura Dern as... Is it Laura? Yeah, Laura Dern as Catherine Harris.
I hope they got the makeup right.
I'm going to have to find somebody that's got HBO and go Sunday night and sit and watch.
Oh, yeah.
It'll be a little bit like Rain Man, where they show up at the lady's house in the middle of nowhere, and because Raymond has to watch Wapner. Of course, Wapner comes on at 3:30.
At the particular time.
Yeah, that'll be. I'll just go knock on somebody's house.
Hello, neighbor.
Yeah.
I brought the popcorn.
Recount comes on in 35 minutes. Recount, definitely Recount. But
you get somebody to record it for you.
Well, have you forgotten where I live?
No.
I live in the
around there.
There probably isn't, if I ask very, very nicely. That would involve using gasoline and driving somewhere, and we're not doing a lot of that these days either.
Well, that's what I say. Have them recorded and mail it to you. Let the post office spend the money on gas.
You're ever so resourceful, aren't you? Speaking of media, however, did you see this story about this guy by the name of Barry Nolan?
No.
This is one of those welcome to Bush America moments, Caro, and I find it harrowing. He was a television host in the Boston area who worked for Comcast, and he was a host on their on the Comcast CN8 channel, which is probably that's one of those channels you get when you buy the it's you know like you know channel 4 or else it's channel 162, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
They had some bona fides, and he got wind of the fact that the New England Emmy chapter was going to honor Bill O'Reilly at its annual awards ceremony and be given the organization's Governor's Award for his excellence as a broadcaster.
Oh, God.
And apparently that went through Barry Nolan's brain like an ice pick.
I guess.
So he emailed members of the chapter encouraging them to protest the appalling choice that had been made for the honor, and went on to say that O'Reilly is delusional, he's a man that mangles the facts, he inflates and constantly mangles the truth. His frequent target is the left-leaning media, the ones who do report the news fairly. And as a result of that, Comcast canned him.
Amazing.
That's where we live now, Caro.
Well, exactly.
I mean, I'm not naive enough to say it's a free speech issue, because Comcast barring contract issues, can fire anybody for saying anything on their time. But did anybody at Comcast sort of look up and say,
what's wrong with this picture? Well, it's like, it's similar to what we were discussing earlier, the conservative scholar concept, the conservative newscaster concept. What? Maybe it's when a newscaster is supposed to present the news? I mean...
No. You're supposed to call people liberal pinheads when you... But yeah, in America in 2008, you cannot feel secure in your job if you suggest that giving an award for broadcasting to Bill O'Reilly is not the best thing that a self-respecting organization would do.
That is sad.
He did go to the dinner. It was May 10th. He went to the dinner, and he handed out flyers at the ceremony until the security goons came up and ran him off.
That's sad, too. That's very sad.
It's...
We have an instance of the Bush Library at SMU, or near SMU, as part of, but to be built on some land owned by the Methodist Church, and the faculty tried to protest, and there was student protests, and now some board of the church is trying to protest because they're saying, you know, I mean, it's not as though this is to be any sort of scholarly endeavor. Again, you know, it's going to be what Bush is planning is having people there, the same kinds of folks we're talking about, all the answers they find to any question fall right along the lines of the conservative ideology, and the purpose will be to promote that kind of thing as opposed to scholarly research.
And of course, it's not just the Bush Presidential Library; it is also there's a so-called conservative think tank that goes with it as well. And the ultimate irony of all this is they're hell-bent on putting it on the campus of Southern Methodist University. Bush isn't even a Methodist. He is a Methodist, but he wouldn't even meet with the leaders of his own church when they were begging to meet with him before he decided to attack Iraq.
Oh yeah. When he goes to church, he goes to the Methodist church, but the Methodist church is very liberal, you know.
Well, it's hanging
on as the Methodist.
It's hanging on to its liberalism. Peter Godbold, whose program follows mine, has done a very good job of laying out the attack. And I don't know if you've ever even heard of this organization, though, Kara. It would be worthy of your attention to dig into it a little bit, find out some about it. An organization called the Institute for Religion and Democracy. The IRD. This is the group that was formed and wormed its way into the Southern Baptist Church and turned it into a wholly owned subsidiary of the Republican National Committee.
Yeah.
And now they are hard at work, and part of their plan is the SMU library, the Bush bookshelf or whatever we're calling it these days. with six copies of My Pet Goat in six different languages. I don't know how you draw a goat in Japanese.
Me neither.
Sorry, being a smart aleck. But part of the whole dodge is to continue the insinuation into the United Methodist Church until they can turn it into as radical a fundamentalist group of goons as they've succeeded in doing to the Southern Baptists.
Mm-hmm.
Because very few people know now, the Southern Baptists used to be a very, very jealous denomination. Insofar, of course, you know, they were born in racism. They split away because they didn't want any of those people coming to their church, all of that. But they were very, very jealous of their First Amendment rights, and it used to be the stated policy of the Southern Baptist Convention that, you know, you keep your politics out of our church and we'll keep our church out of your politics. Until the IRD...
Well, that went away.
Yeah, it did, and it was by virtue of people like Jerry Falwell and the Institute for Religion and Democracy just sleazing its way in and seizing control of the organization so that you know, Bush wouldn't meet with the leaders of his own church, but the year that he attacked Iraq, if you recall, he went and actually spoke to the Southern Baptist Convention's annual meeting, and the Southern Baptists rewarded him by telling him that they thought Jesus would bomb Iraq, too.
Jesus would bomb Iraq.
No, I'm I'm a smartass a lot of the time, Carol, but I'm deadly in earnest on that one. Yeah, Jesus would approve of bombing Iraq because render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. Really, that's the rationale that they put out there.
So it kind of comes back to the peace.
Yeah, take up thy M16 and follow me. You didn't read that part, did you? No, not hardly. But you know, John McCain went and chased after, as we said, that the endorsements of Rod Parsley and John Hagee. He had to chase after them because at the time they were sort of second tier, because James Dobson was swearing up and down, you know, Dr. Dobson, who couldn't put a Band-Aid on without killing somebody. He's one of those kind of doctors. Dr. Dobson was swearing up and down he'd sit it out before the day would ever dawn on that he would go to the booth and vote for John McCain. So he felt like he had to chase down somebody in the religion industry, you know, some evangelical, and get their stamp of approval. And the question for me is whether or not, like I said, whether America will pay any attention to this, or for those evangelicals in the pews, whether they'll go, well, you know, it had to happen. This, otherwise they would have just persecuted poor McCain into the ground, and him being a war hero and all. But I don't think it's done, and I don't think it's going to go away, and I don't think these rotten fundamentalists are going to stop their attacks on our constitutional form of government until such time as we have run them to the ground.
I'm not sure that they're ever going to give up.
Maybe if we get a government that's serious enough, Caro, to actually issue some sort of an executive order telling the IRS, which is a branch of the Treasury Department, right?
Mm-hmm.
Telling them to take their own laws seriously and start busting these people who are running these tax dodges and calling them churches. I mean, can you even see that happening? Is that beyond the pale?
Well, again, until you get money out of the process, you know.
Right.
You're kind of all of our politicians are captive to these moneyed interests. You know, I just can't emphasize that enough, that to me, money is the root of all political evil.
Well, we've covered that ground before, and I couldn't agree with you more. Just sort of moving over into a couple of other corners of the news. Did you notice that the guy who has pretty much been keeping a lot of Iraqis to the extent that they are, you know, just sort of trying to live their lives, keeping them on the calm, has now changed his tune? You remember, what's his name? Ayatollah Ali Sistani?
Yeah.
He started issuing fatwas against American soldiers.
Yes.
This is not going to end nicely, is it?
No.
And, you know, we had the House of Representatives doing the right thing earlier. The Republicans helped, but they killed the Iraq funding bill.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Senate today said, well, we're not going to do that. We're going to pass the Iraq funding bill, and they put Senator Webb's GI Bill for the 21st Century in it. And Bush has sworn to veto it. But I guess now, is it your understanding now that has to go back to the House? Since the House killed...
Yes, if the Senate makes any changes to any bill that has been passed by the House, then it has to go to a conference committee.
But the bill wasn't passed by the House. That's where I'm confused.
Oh, it wasn't even passed by the House. So I guess it still has the opportunity to go back to the House.
So it just bounces back over, I guess, as the Senate's version, and then the House considers it.
I guess.
And so, this has funding in it, I think, Caro, for up through April of next year for Afghanistan and Iraq. But it also has the veterans funding and some. It also has something else that's at least worth considering, and that is an extension of unemployment benefits for 13 weeks. How do the Republicans and George Bush explain to America that people who are scared to death and unemployed aren't worth the same level of concern that, say, Bear Stearns was?
I don't know that they do bother to.
I mean, is that where we are? You know, the New York Times today told George Bush that if he couldn't lead, that he could at least get out of the way.
Yeah, that is not in George Bush's nature to get out of the way.
Well, no, it isn't. But how much? Your guess? How much of the American people are the American people finally figuring out about what's been going on?
Well, according to Zogby, but of course, you know, Zogby tends to find the answers that they want to find. Speaking of somebody that does that for the left, according to Zogby, only 23% of Americans still approve of Bush and what he's doing. You know, I don't think any of the other polls have ever gone below like 28% or something like that. But then again, they find that, you know, only 11% of Americans think Congress is doing a good job. So.
But in a way, I think you can explain the congressional thing away, because everybody likes their own congressman and hates the rest.
Well, yes, but you also have to consider that 2006 was a big deal. It was a big election, and Americans thought they were voting for a real change of course. And instead of using that mandate, the Democrats started getting, they became jellyfish again, despite the fact that they had this, they have all of America behind them. Do this, stop this war, stop this march toward the cliff economically, all of these bad things that the Republicans have been doing. Change it.
Oh, speaking of bad things that Republicans have been doing, are you inclined to believe the report out of Israeli Army Radio and the Jerusalem Post that George intends to bomb Iran before he's gone?
I believe that he really, really, really wants to.
Do you think
and
he will?
If you remember, we had all this back and forth stuff before Iraq as well.
Oh, yes. That's the thing. I do remember it.
And that's part of what scares me here. But also bear in mind, remember, my basic theory about this election is that George Bush has got to keep his butt out of prison.
He's working on his get-out-of-jail-free card, and I agree. That's their motivation.
He will do anything, make any human being other than himself make any sacrifice to keep his butt out of prison. If that includes, starting another war, without the troops to do it, no matter what it costs, he'll do it.
Well, what if it's just a matter of lighting up the sky with a big old bombing, say a 72-hour bombing campaign that'll... are the American people still... Are we still terrifiable? Did you listen to that Rumsfeld tape?
I don't know. I never understood why we were so terrifiable to begin with. I never understood the 2004 deal.
Well, I didn't either. But this notion that, because the other thing that keeps getting, we're not going to send any troops in. We're just going to bomb the bejesus out of them.
Yeah, a bunch of civilians and.
Well, what about what John Conyers did, telling him that impeachment proceedings would begin immediately if he did?
When has anything like that ever stopped George Bush?
You're making it tough, Caro. I'm looking for some hope here.
I'm sorry, but you cannot trust that man. He will do what he wants to do, and
until somebody stops him.
Be damned.
Yeah, until somebody tries to stop him.
Well, until somebody sits on him, and I don't know who can do that at this point. They've built him up so much, I think that a lot of this rogueness is because, you know, Cheney is such a warmonger, and Cheney managed to flatter George Bush to the point where, you know, oh, you're the war president, you're the this, you're the that, you have to use all your political capital because that's the only thing that will make the world safe for the oil companies, and et cetera, et cetera. I don't know how he phrased it, but whatever it was perfect because it made George Bush think that, you know, he was ordained by God to make the world safe for the oil companies.
Yeah, or ordained by God. ordained by ExxonMobil. It's the same thing in the long run, isn't it?
It is. On this earth, yeah, it is.
Well, with that being...
rendering unto Caesar.
Oh. And you know, we do some renditions. That I caught that story that just about blew the top of my little skull off. When I saw that at least in one instance at Guantanamo, we've used snakes to... snakes?
Yeah.
Yeah, snakes.
Oh, yeah.
Who are we? Where are we?
It's inhuman. It's just inhuman.
You know, gay porn, forced cross-dressing. Can we finally just have done with it and admit that that the White House has turned into like a bondage and domination escort service? I mean, the woman who killed herself?
Honor. The Republicans were going to bring honor back to the White House. Remember?
Oh, that's what that is.
That's what it is. It's honor.
And Jeff Gannon and hot military studs for you. Is it possible, will anybody ever be able to fully catalog, Caro, the nastiness of the last 8 years?
Only if they want to. Only if they want to. And what worries me is that, you know, if it's a Republican in next, a lot of this stuff will never see the light of day. And even if it's a Democrat in next, we still may never see a lot of it. Still may never see the light of day because.
Well, the volume of it is almost too staggering to keep up with, isn't it?
there's a lot of it. Even the stuff that has become public is gargantuan. You know, so imagine all the stuff that has not become public.
Tons of it. And I think back, and it's another one of those run around the room tearing at my hair and ripping my clothes off sort of moments. I think back to the $70 million that we spent for Ken Starr's little pornography report.
Mm-hmm.
We need an investigation, don't we?
Yes.
Where would you prioritize investigating the last 8 years for the incoming Congress?
I would make it a very high priority because what we have to do is to repair the damage that has been done to every single agency. I believe every single agency's purpose has been turned completely on its head, and the purpose has become to do the exact opposite of what the agency was established for. Either that or it was starved into submission and, you know, not able to do its mission because of cutbacks and, you know, political intimidation, God knows what, okay? And to root all of that out, to change it, to fix it, you have to root it out. You have to know what was done. Now, personally, I'm of the opinion that Hillary Clinton is the one that will roll up her sleeves and get that done.
Well, I was going to ask, regardless of let's assume a Democratic president, regardless of which one it is, Do you think it is fair for the American people, or reasonable, not fair, but reasonable, for us to say to an incoming president who is going to have an absolute nightmare on his or her hands, listen, we know you're busy, but we'd really, really, really like to see some effort spent on fixing what went wrong, and no President Clinton, no President Obama, you don't get to be a unitary executive.
Oh, well, Clinton has already said that she repudiates all of that, that she will do away with signing statements, that, I mean, she has a whole list of things that she disagrees with in terms of what Bush has done. She wants to restore the separation of powers and the balance of powers and all of that. I don't know. I have not heard of any similar statement by Obama. The only thing I've heard from him in a similar regard is that he did say he would have the Justice Department investigate the previous administration.
Well, I think both of those positions are a little bit better than the let's let bygones be bygones approach, which I understand but don't agree with, that Bill took when he took over from H.W. Bush.
Well, it was such a serious mistake because I think he thought, you know, being the nice guy that he is, I think he probably thought, oh, well, if I do away with these investigations, the Iran-Contra investigations, then we can all, you know, shake hands and be friends. Or if not friends, at least be able to communicate with one another.
We're all Americans here. We're all going in the same direction. We want to get there maybe in different ways, but we can work out our differences.
And, of course, they attacked him and attacked him.
Yeah, for as sharp a guy as he was and is, what a profound lapse of judgment.
People don't always make decisions based on reason, you know. People often make decisions based on emotion or based on their hopes as opposed to their cold, calculated understanding of the world. And it was a big mistake that he made, that Clinton made, in, you know, in thinking that that, you know, he could make friends with these people.
You know, the one of the things that I did notice was that with Senator Webb's GI Bill for the 21st century, both Senator Clinton and Senator Obama managed to find their way back to the Senate to both speak regarding that legislation and vote on it. Senator McCain-Turian, McCain did it, forgot where Washington was.
He forgot how to get there,
Yeah, and all this business about, you know, I've got a right to speak out for the military. I'm the voice of authority on the military. Obviously, neither Democrat still contending for the nomination has military bona fides.
Right.
And there is no constitutional requirement.
But neither did George Bush or Dick Cheney.
There's that. So this comes back to another one of those media things, Caro. Without having to get really kind of nasty about things and saying, you know, will you Republicans kindly shove it up, you know, shove your military experience where the sun doesn't shine? How do we attack that? How do we deflate that, or something, you know, in some way to, because, you know, they destroyed John Kerry, who was an actual war hero.
Yes.
And now, For far more than John Kerry ever did, you know, he stood there and said, you know, reporting for duty, and they slaughtered him over it.
Yeah,
John.
But that's typically what they do. They generally go after what they consider a person's strength. That's the Rovian tactic: is you take whatever is considered the opposition's strength, and you cream them on it.
It's going to be a long
lies. You know, you don't worry about telling, you know, saying that it's a lie, because they're going to lie. They lie all the time.
Well, that's true. Saying that they lie is like saying the sun came up.
That's right.
But at some point in time, I get the sense that we're really, you know, because he was in the Hanoi Hilton for 5 years, you know. Do you think between now and November that anybody might actually dare to delve into some of the allegations about his conduct in Hanoi, McCain's?
I don't know. Certainly not the media, because they love the guy. They're not going to be the ones to do it. And presumably, with all of the length of time that he's been in politics, surely the information is available. But then the information about his dealings with the Keating Five is available.
And
today, this very day, his relationships with a lot of lobbyists are public information. We know about them.
And Cliff Schechter has detailed in minute fashion a lot of this stuff about McCain in his new book, The Real McCain. But the thing with those that always bothers me, Caro, is that those books, as good as they are, tend to get read by the choir, if you will.
Yes, that's right.
And it becomes an issue. And I don't know, apart from, you know, some of the TV stuff we were talking about, what is Middle America? And I'm not talking geographically. I'm talking about middle class America. If you put lists of John McCain's shortcomings and misdeeds next to the price per gallon on the gas pump, would they notice?
Well, then you run into the problem that they've been told for so long what a good guy he is, and what a maverick he is, and what a war hero he is, and so on and so on. And that's been ingrained for so long, and it's hard for people to make a jump, a real change in their assessment of somebody. If I told you that George Washington diddled little boys, okay, you'd say, wait a minute.
Yeah, stop that. Yeah.
Because it's called cognitive dissonance. That is so far from what you understand about the man or believe about him that it can't compute. Okay, it was a similar thing with George Bush, the way they made a saint of him and how Churchillian he was. His speeches were Churchillian and all of this, you know, I'm going.
Who was that awful woman that said Bush was Churchillian?
It was Peggy Noonan.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. yeah, Peggy Nooner. Yeah. takes a lot of nerve, you know. Churchillian,
yeah,
George
it
Bush.
It took a lot of chinks in the armor. I think the first big chink in the armor was Katrina.
Even
after he invaded a country where we didn't find it on the excuse that there were weapons of mass destruction there that were aimed at us, and then not finding any, even that didn't faze people for a while. It was when they saw the utter and complete disregard for human beings in the Katrina aftermath that they said, something's seriously wrong here. And that's when they started to the high regard for George Bush started to erode and erode and erode. But it takes just that, you can only do it a tiny, tiny bit at a time.
And
I mean, those of us who saw through him in 1999, it's second nature to us. But to a lot of people, they thought very highly of him. I remember getting emails from people in 2000 where this one woman who was very religious and, oh, he's just a wonder. He's such a saintly man, and he's such a this and a that. I said, but
where did that come from?
They believe what they want to believe.
Oh, we're back to faith-based biology, aren't we?
Well, no, we're back to Bush was an expert dog whistler. Okay, he was an expert at saying things that would indicate to people who have a certain set of beliefs or terminology that he shared their beliefs. Okay. For example, the big example that comes to mind is the No Child Left Behind Act. That terminology was reminiscent of the Left Behind series.
Oh yeah.
Books.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So in other words,
dog whistling. I get it. Yeah.
He was dog whistling to the religious right wing that this is your entree into domination.
And even the ham-fisted, heavy-handed stuff like, you know, faith-based initiative.
Yes.
Office of faith-based,
yes.
Yada, yada, yada.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, yes.
I see. Well, Caro, I hope you have a wonderful Memorial Day weekend. Any barbecues planned or going out and about or anything?
I don't plan to. Just hang around.
Hang around and
pray for January
20th. Yeah, I know.
What are y'all planning?
I'm going to fire up the smoker and make a little homemade barbecue sauce and put some hickory smoke to a pork shoulder and
throw a little rosemary on that.
I'll do that.
I believe it was rosemary because, you know, that grilling process can put carcinogens on the meat.
That's true. That's true.
So I believe it's – read my website today. I believe it's rosemary in the science section.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, yeah.
I will go and do that before we fire up the smoker.
Yeah, before you fire up and decide just how you want it to check the science section and see.
I absolutely will, and thanks for reminding me of that because there's so much more at the website than just the stuff that. Well, I love the science and the technology and the communications and the media
me
stuff.
Too. I just think science is so fascinating that how anybody would want to stop it and stop them from rosemary. There it is. Yeah, rosemary. Touch of rosemary.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, Caro, have a wonderful Memorial Day weekend to you and yours. And we'll be talking to you next Friday.
Okie doke.
All right, take care.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye now. From MakeThemAccountable.com, our pal Carolyn Kay. And coming up here in a minute, we will get Cindy Sheehan on the line and start our conversation with her for this evening. So we'll take a little break and come back. And like I said, Cindy Sheehan is on her way. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn, and we'll be back.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Coming up on 6 minutes past the hour, this is Head On. Hour number two, just like B-Rez said. And I'm really, really, I've been looking forward to this conversation for quite some time now. Cindy Sheehan and I have never spoken before, but I have followed her courageous work from afar. And it is a real pleasure and indeed an honor to welcome her to the program to chat for a little bit here about her ongoing and upcoming contest and, in fact, mission, I would think it would be safe to say, in attempting to unseat Nancy Pelosi. Cindy, welcome to the program. Thanks again.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
It's a real pleasure. Let's get right out of the gate. How's the campaign going?
Right now we're embarking on our drive to collect 10,198 signatures to get me on the ballot as a declined estate in California's 8th District. We have a lot of excitement. We have a lot of volunteers helping us. And the longer we're in San Francisco, the more energy that's coming to the campaign for us. So it is it's an uphill battle. It's a struggle. It's really hard, but we're doing it, and it's just been very rewarding so far.
Where are you seeing your support come from? Is it where you would typically expect it, or are there some unexpected pockets of support?
Well, you know, we, of course, when we first got to San Francisco last August, we had our natural support was from anti-war activists, human rights activists, social justice activists, people that I have been working with very closely since my son was killed in April of 2004. We've started to get a lot of support from labor, a lot of support from students, a lot of support from the African-American community and the Latino community. So it just really is a very diverse diverse campaign. We've had Ron Paul Republicans come and volunteer and be excited about our campaign. And, of course, progressive Democrats are on board. So I think we just really have to convince the people of the California's 8th District that we have a deep problem in our country, and I think most of them know that. But Nancy Pelosi is not the solution. In fact, we believe that she's a stumbling block to the solution. So we have to present our campaign, my candidacy, and my potential, you know, role as representative for California's 8th District as part of the solution.
Well, Cindy, obviously, as you noted, you began this coming out of the anti-war movement, but so many of the things that the Democratic Congress have done or not done expand beyond that. Where do other issues, you know, energy policy,
right,
unemployment, the flagging economy, the housing bubble, the subprime crisis, where do all of those fit into the puzzle as far as your opposition to Mrs. Pelosi and the way she's attempted to lead the House?
Well, you know, we have, of course, I'm well known for my anti-war activism and my opposition to George Bush and Dick Cheney. My call for impeachment, I've been calling for their impeachment since the travesty of the 2004 election, the day after I started calling for their impeachment. I believe that there's so many problems in this country, but fundamentally it all goes back to our country's dependence to and our elected leadership's allegiance to the military-industrial complex. Our Pentagon budget is for the first time going to go over $1 trillion when you count all the other departments that in the federal government, for example, the, you know, Homeland Security, the Department of Energy that oversees our nuclear weaponry program, you know, we don't even know how much the Pentagon spends when we talk about black ops. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan or the occupations are costing our country $16 billion a month that we're borrowing from China. Our dollar is tanking as the price of oil goes up. We need an energy policy that is not something where we're hoping that the cars get 35 miles a gallon by 2018. That might be way too late. We have to cut our dependence to fossil fuels, foreign or domestic, and have a really spend that money on not developing sustainable sources of energy, because we already have those, but investing in those things that will use our sustainable forms of energy to cut back, to reduce, to recycle, to reuse. That's a huge problem that we're having all over the world, not just in this country and not just in my district. Education is suffering badly across the country. In California, we have a horrible budget crisis, which our governor has linked directly to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And instead of, you know, figuring out how to bring our troops home and start trimming our defense budget, it's nothing about defense, the first thing they talk about is cutting education. And to me, that is, of course, with all the money we're borrowing, with our economy, you know, tanking, with the environment tanking, we're not investing in our future. And taking money out of our children's schools is, you know, a direct detriment to the future of humanity. And so there's just so many issues that we have to solve. But the first thing we have to solve, like I said, is our country's allegiance to the military-industrial complex.
And it's interesting when you mention that, Cindy. Maybe I'm wrong, but I've heard, and perhaps it's apocryphal, but that when Dwight Eisenhower first moved to coin that phrase, the military-industrial complex, that his initial phrase was the military-industrial congressional complex.
Right.
And I think what you're identifying is that this all begins to it all ties together. You mentioned impeachment. What do you think of John Conyers' recent statement that if George Bush sort of unilaterally decides to bomb Iran, that he will begin impeachment proceedings? Is it a day late and a dollar short?
Well, yes, many days late, and you know, billions of dollars short. And hundreds of thousands of lives already. I mean, I've had many long conversations with Congressman Conyers. I was arrested in his office July 23rd last year demanding impeachment. And why is he going to wait till, you know, possibly tens of thousands of more people are killed in another country devastated, and perhaps the beginning of World War III? Because Iran's not going to sit back, and the Middle East is so unstable right now. Who knows what will happen if our country launches another war of aggression? So no, start talking about impeachment now. Start filing articles of impeachment and holding them accountable for what they've already done. They've already committed so many crimes against humanity, crimes against our Constitution, high crimes and misdemeanors that I think it's just another one of Congressman Conyers' empty threats.
Really?
Yes.
Well, I'm skeptical of it myself too, because it seemed when you remember when they would when we would say, you know, we need to set a date for getting the heck out of Iraq, and the Bush administration would say, well, that'll just tell them when they can ramp it up against us. If we tell George Bush that the impeachment articles would only the hearings would only begin if he attacks Iran, doesn't that just sort of give him a free pass to do it right after the November elections?
Absolutely, or to do it now. You know, it takes time to do this. I know the impeachment of Bill Clinton took 3 months from start to finish. So I think it's just another delaying tactic that Congressman Conyers is putting forth. And I don't think that And with my experience with the Bush administration and my experience with their administration for the past 7 years, I don't think that that would restrain their hand at all. And they don't pay attention to subpoenas. They don't pay attention to any kind of, look, Peter Libby was convicted and his sentence was commuted. And they've already told the committees that if they subpoena Harriet Myers or Josh Bolton or other people, that they're not going to follow Congress's rule of law, and that's their mandate to do this. That's why they were put into power, to put a rein on the Bush administration, and the Bush administration will not be reined in. So,
do you view your
impeachment now for what he has done already?
Right, believe me, I'm on the side of the angels with you as far as that's concerned.
I'm just so frustrated with Congress. I'm frustrated with many people thought that in November of 06, when the Democrats, the so-called opposition party, regained control of both houses, even though it's a tenuous majority in the Senate, that there would be some change. There would be a change of direction, that they would put in checks and balances that have been lacking in the first 6 years of the Bush administration. Congress has practically invalidated itself when they just roll over and give George Bush everything he wants, everything he asked for.
Well, Senator Robert Byrd, with whom I have a lot of issues, but got the war at least partially right, said that Congress completely abdicated its authority in allowing George Bush to go to war with Iraq. As you think about, you know, I understand you're in the petition stage of your candidacy, but as you contemplate what your campaign looks like, how do you address people in the 8th district who are concerned with the tremendous power that Nancy Pelosi has accumulated and her ability to quote unquote bring home the bacon to the district? As compared with yourself, who will of course be a relatively powerless freshman member of the House.
Well, we know that Nancy Pelosi is, of course, one of the queens of pork, and the people who are excited about my candidacy, the grassroots people, like I said before, the people of color, the working class, the workers. They don't see any of that pork. It all goes to her donors, what they call the downtown Democrats, the Democratic fat cats. It does not trickle down to the people of San Francisco who are suffering from affordable housing crunch, where it costs an arm and a leg to live in that city. We have good public transportation, but as with everything else, it's being cut back. Our schools are being cut back, like I said. So San Francisco is one of the most strategically important cities in the United States of America. San Francisco is going to get what San Francisco needs, regardless who is the congressperson. We have a lot of powerful congresspeople in the Bay Area, and I've worked with them intensively, since my son was killed, George Miller, Barbara Lee, Lynn Woolsey. You know, I've worked with these people before, and I'm pretty sure that we'll work together again. They're not endorsing my candidacy because, of course, they're all Democrats. But when we take out the most powerful Democrat in Congress, well, allegedly, arguably the most powerful Democrat, I know that she does have people also pulling her strings, that's going to send a clear message to the rest of Congress that the people of America mean business when we say we want change. The people of America mean business when we say we want to be represented and not the corporations anymore.
Well, let's talk about the petition process itself. It varies, of course, from state to state, and you mentioned the number that you have to get. And I guess that represents, what, 1% of the people in the district that voted in the last election? Is that correct?
Correct.
How do you, how do you organize something like that? Where do if someone wants to support your candidacy, how do they get to a petition to sign it?
Okay, California has the fourth strictest rules for declined to state or independent candidate. They make us jump through over so many hurdles and through so many hoops. It's designed to keep the power of the people and the voice of the people suppressed. So it is a very intense and difficult process that we're going through.
Is it a physical process, Cindy? Does it have to?
We have to get out in the community. It has to be registered voters from California's 8th district collecting the signatures, and they have to be from right. And the signatures have to be valid registered voters in California's 8th district. So we figure we have to get at least 15,000 to get 10,198 valid signatures. So we go to farmers markets, we go to the BART stations, we go to supermarkets, people come in the office to sign the petition, people pick up petitions, we go to all the events in town to get signatures. You know, there's always some kind of progressive event going on. And it's just really, since San Francisco is a magnet city, and many times when there are events like that, a lot of the people aren't in California's 8th district or aren't voters in that district. So what people outside of the district can do, we've been extremely stressed over since we could start collecting money in October of 2007. We have so far collected over $160,000. And that's come from mostly people outside the district. As you can imagine, there's almost a corporate media blackout on our candidacy in San Francisco. So we have to be very proactive in being our own media, getting our message out to the people of San Francisco that, yes, we're running. Yes, we're serious. Yes, we're here to win. Yes, we're here to represent true San Francisco values, not the people who live in mansions on the hill, even though we'll represent them too, but true San Francisco values need to be represented, and I'm the one that will do that. So people can donate to our campaign at cindyforcongress.org. We have a grassroots action center. We have things that people can do from their homes for our campaign, but not only for our campaign, but from their homes to put pressure on Congress, to sign other petitions that the people outside the district can do. So our website is like a clearinghouse for grassroots action to get me elected. Cynthia McKinney, who's trying to get the Green nomination for president, has called me America's next congresswoman. And I just want to assure everybody who has a progressive voice, who knows that there is a humane solution for these problems, that they will have a voice in Congress. And I want to, you know, assure my district that I'm not going to go into Congress thinking that I have an entitlement now and I have a position for life. But these positions are performance-based. And your listeners who are listening need to challenge their Congress people if they're not representing the true values of their district and say, we can fire you. We can replace you with somebody who will if you don't. And that would be something to help my campaign too.
Well, I certainly identify with that, Cindy, because I'm speaking to you from West Virginia right now. And our congressional delegation is very frustrating to us on a number of levels because, among other things, they turn a blind eye or actively participate in encouraging the destruction of our homes. My house here in West Virginia is rattled on a daily basis, as are many other West Virginians' homes, by the effects of 3 million pounds of high explosives being used to remove our mountaintops here. When you say that you're going to be a progressive voice for all America, I take it then that you will be interested in issues that that speak to Americans outside the 8th District, while at the same time you have to understandably focus on the needs of that district. Is that a fair assumption?
That's an absolute fair subject. By the way, I'm in Radford, Virginia right now, so I'm not actually too physically far from you.
Oh, okay, yeah, sure.
Yeah, I'm at a conference in Radford. But, I've had to bring my international activism since August of 05 when I first set up camp in Crawford, Texas. I've been traveling the world, and it's just really amazing how every international issue is also a local issue. And when our main candidates talk about clean coal when there's really no such thing, instead of saying we need a policy that will put people to work exploring and developing and putting to use the technology we have for clean energy to not destroy our planet, to not destroy our ecology, to not destroy our people's future, that's a very important issue to us in San Francisco also. We have a place in San Francisco called Bayview Hunters Point that the United States Navy contaminated over decades of nuclear testing and other kinds of contaminants that have been sent into the airstream because of greedy developers that want to develop those toxic sites. So we're very aware of clean energy and sustainable jobs and sustainable forms of energy, and to think about the people who are being harmed before the corporations that profit off of people's sickness, death, the loss of their homes, the loss of their, you know, ancestral areas that they've been living in for generations. That's very important to me and to also the constituency of California's 8th District.
Well, I think it's telling that you're able to so well address issues such as what I just raised, because when I heard you say that there's no such thing as clean coal, I know that you have acquainted yourself with the issue, and I think that's very important, Cindy, because you're showing that while the core of your activism and the core of your drive rests in the motivation that brought you to the anti-war movement to begin with and led you to basically create the anti-war movement, that you recognize that our problems are multifaceted and that as such you've got to be prepared to address them. What kind of time frame are you on in terms of the petition process? How much under the gun are you?
Well, we have to have all the signatures by August 9th. So in less than 3 months, a little over 2 months, we have about 1,000 now, so we need to get at least 13,000 more before August 9th. So if, I know your listeners aren't voters in my district, but if they can go to our website, if they can spread the word to help us get on the ballot. And one thing we're running to in San Francisco is what you've mentioned. Oh, she's the Speaker of the House. You know, it's very prestigious. So how is it prestigious to have a Speaker of the House that is failing at her job? How is it prestigious for San Francisco to have somebody sitting in that very important position in our country that every time she gives George Bush more money for war, she signs a death warrant for literally tens of thousands of more people? So that's what I was talking about, San Francisco values. San Francisco, true San Francisco values are humane values. And since Casey was killed, I was anti-war, I was anti-George Bush, but now I know that it is the system that we have to fight against. And Nancy Pelosi is queen of the system. She's part of it. She's detrimental to democracy. And having a two-party system that really is just a duopoly of sameness, except for some very extraordinary people who have been able to resist being co-opted totally into the party system, that suppresses democracy. It does not enhance democracy. We need more voices. We need more parties. we need more people involved in the process to have really to have true and viable democracy.
Well, you speak.
We're over in Iraq trying to spread democracy when we don't even have a viable democracy in America.
You speak of San Francisco values, and I think this is an American, an all-around American value, but probably resonates quite well in San Francisco, Cindy. What about the issue you've mentioned on a number of times now, issues relating to money and the influence that it purchases? As a member of Congress, would you be willing to author, to introduce, to push as hard as you possibly could meaningful financial reform within that body?
Well, absolutely. My campaign has been funded totally by grassroots donations. Our average donation is $55, and that's $160,000 we've raised with the average donation of $55. We have, you know, I always vary with a lot of integrity, so I won't accept corporate donations. But I haven't been offered any corporate donations yet, but, you know, if that happens, I won't accept it. I think that corporations and lobbyists have no place in our government. They should not have offices in Washington, D.C. They should not have first crack at our representatives' time. They shouldn't be writing legislation. Their legislation only hurts workers, hurts the American people, hurts people around the world with their greed for profit. I think that they have no place in our government. I think campaigns should be publicly funded. I think there should be a limit to the amount that can be spent on campaigns, the amount of time that can be wasted on them also. And I think our almost entire electoral process has to be reformed so we can ensure that the voice of the people is heard and not the voice of the corporations. By the time we have two candidates running for president, we know full well that it's the corporate media that's in league with. When we look at the corporate media, they're owned by people like General Electric, war profiteers, consumer product profiteers. And so it's all linked together. It's all linked to keep them in power and to keep their interests served first before the public's interest. That's why we don't have universal health care here. It's not about socialized. People say, oh, that's socialized medicine. We already have socialized medicine. We have Medicare. We have the VA system. Congress has a great insurance plan when you become a member of Congress. But our representatives are beholden to big pharma and the insurance companies, not because it's socialized medicine, not because that scares them. So 35 million to 50 million Americans go without health care because they don't have health insurance. And it's because of the people who line our elected representatives' pockets.
That all makes eminently good sense. And part of my purpose here, Cindy, has been to everyone knows you as a voice and a face of the anti-war movement, but part of my purpose has been to try to expand upon the idea that you are versed in the other issues and that you are ready to take them on and to tackle them. I think you've done an admirable job of showing that, and I hope that, you talk about the corporatized media. We've got a new phrase we use for it. We call it the for-profit media. Because that's what we're not.
Right.
This is an entirely independent operation. We've grown in 2.5 years from zero to thousands upon thousands upon thousands of listeners every night. So you've just had a chance to really expand upon who you are beyond the public face that they know and make viable your ambitions. With that in mind, it's cindyforcongress.org, is that correct?
CindyForCongress.org. That's correct.
And although folks can't collect signatures for you or sign the petition from out of your district, they can certainly give to your campaign, and that enables you to do more. Cindy Sheehan, I hope that we'll hear from you again in the future. I wish you the very best.
Best of time, and give you updates on the campaign, and And hopefully the next time will be after we're on the ballot and we can really come out hitting these issues very strongly.
I hope so. I do hope so indeed, and I wish you the very best and there at the conference in Radford and in all of your travels and in what has got to be a pretty brutal schedule of pounding the pavement in the 8th District. You have our sincere best hopes behind you.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on tonight.
Oh, thank you, Cindy, and you take care. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
We will.
Bye now. Cindy Sheehan, not on the ballot yet, working to get on the ballot. And, yeah, she's right. California does make it very difficult. Compare this, please. In each instance, California requires in both a congressional district and in a statewide ballot referendum petition signatures of 1% of the people who voted in the last election. Just by way of comparison, Cindy is still struggling to get on the ballot, and she has until August to bring down something like, well, you heard her, 13,000 to 15,000 votes so that they will have 10,000 verified in order to qualify as an independent candidate on the November ballot. On the other hand, even as we speak, the right-wing fundamentalist hate-mongers already have the numbers to put a so-called marriage amendment on the California ballot, an amendment to the California Constitution. That's the uphill climb we face. That's the uphill climb that liberals and progressives face. And I don't have one whit of compunction arguing that Cindy Sheehan should run against and be helped to defeat Nancy Pelosi. Because Nancy Pelosi is another one of those Congress people who I'm pretty sure doesn't share anything in the way of values with me. Nancy Pelosi does not know what it means to have to deal with a very, very, very finite family budget. She doesn't know what it means to worry about the price of clothing for one's children at the beginning and middle of a school year, or what it means when your kid comes to you and says, you know, I gotta have some new shoes because I've grown out of the ones I was in. And for a family to have to look around and say, you know, he or she's got to have shoes. Where's the shoe money? Nancy Pelosi doesn't know anything about shoe money. When Nancy Pelosi wants a full tank of gasoline, Nancy Pelosi sends someone to get a full tank of gasoline. Whether it's $2 a gallon, $5 a gallon, or $20 a gallon, it's a no-brainer. It's not even a no-brainer. It's not even remotely on the radar. I think Cindy at least understands what it is that working people face. You heard her say that she's getting some help independently from people. I don't think labor unions per se, but from people who are members of organized labor. There's a reason those people are doing that. A damn good reason as far as I'm concerned. CindyForCongress.org, and it's F-O-R, not the numeral 4. CindyForCongress.org. Spread the word. Spread the help. Spread the hope. And let's go to the phones. Hi, welcome to the program. Who have I got?
Hey, Bob, it's Preston.
Hey, Preston, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. Great interview. I'll definitely visit Cindy's site soon. And she's another courageous person who was kind of, who's been through the right-wing media grinder. And they went after her, tried to humiliate her. There's a right-wing radio host, I forget her name, but wrote some scurrilous book.
Laura Ingraham.
Is there one named Melanie Morgan?
Melanie Morgan, yeah. She's the one that just got ditched out in San Francisco.
Oh, progress.
Yeah, that all started with, do you remember the blogger named Spocko? Spocko started taking Melanie Morgan down, and eventually, and her contract didn't get renewed here in the last couple of months.
Oh, great. Great.
Melanie Morgan's also the same woman who said that she wanted to paint a big target, a big bullseye, in the middle of Nancy Pelosi's forehead. And see, that's one of the dichotomies we have to deal with. Are you under the opinion that Nancy, and I'm not, this is not an attack, Preston, are you under the opinion that Nancy Pelosi's a liberal? Because I'm not.
You know, I think she's a mix. I think you were making a very good point earlier about the class differences and how detached sometimes wealthier people can be from the struggles of working class people. At the same time, I think her presence and her tone and some of the things she does, like traveling to Syria to speak with officials, that did anger the more rightist elements in this country, and I appreciate her for doing that. And I don't know, some of her other policies I'm not really familiar with, but I'm sure I'd find a mix of good and bad stuff.
Probably. For me, I had a sort of a turning point, and I know it's unfair, Preston, but it is the way that we make decisions and form impressions. I had sort of a turning point with Nancy Pelosi when I read a quote that was attributed to her, and no reason not to think it was real, where she described the anti-war and impeachment protests in front of her home in San Francisco, and she was angry. And she said, you know, these people come and they camp out in front of my house and they make noise and they're vagrants. And I could call the police and have them hauled away, but because they've got to end the war or an impeach Bush sign, they're political, so I have to put up with it. And that's a pretty close approximation of what she said. And I just looked at that, Preston, and I thought, lady, maybe once upon a time you knew what it was about, but that tells me that you've really lost sight of a lot.
I actually saw some footage of some protesters in England who were very, very concerned about environmental issues, and they went to the house of a executive for, I want to say, Shell. And what motivated them was the recent hanging of Ken Sarawiwa, the Nigerian activist who was protesting Shell's oil development in the Niger Delta.
I'm familiar with his story, yes.
Yeah. And for your listeners, he and I think 8 or 9 other activists were hanged, and Shell kind of just watched as it went on, didn't protest at all, and they've got some financial connections with these paramilitary forces. But anyway, so these protesters went to this house of an executive for Shell. They hung banners and they did chants and stuff. And interestingly, the executive came out and he and his wife started dialoguing with them. And they actually made tea and sat down with them. And it was interesting how they handled it. And actually, I think it's a scene from that film, The Corporation.
Okay.
That documentary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But anyway, I hope Nancy can figure out a way to dialogue more with these protesters. You know, do you remember when she said something about impeachment is off the table?
Far too well, yes.
Yeah. You know, and that angered me. But I must say, a few weeks later, somebody suggested, and I don't know if this is true, but somebody suggested that her thinking and the people around her is if they impeach Bush and Cheney, then I think a Republican would take their place. And if it's a more appealing Republican, then they'd have an incumbent who could get elected. See what I'm saying?
Oh, I understand. I understand the reasoning behind it, Preston. But I'm real hard-headed about the Constitution.
True.
And I don't believe that you can take a provision that is constitutionally provided for and essentially say that there is no way under any circumstance that you would engage that provision. Because when you say that, you're saying that the oath you swore to uphold the Constitution is without meaning. So that, I mean, that was what was so offensive about it to me, because, you know, because I speak in hyperbolic terms from time to time, and I'm the first one to recognize that.
Me too.
But what it says is that if George Bush took an AK-47 and started running up and down Pennsylvania Avenue, gunning people down, that Nancy Pelosi would turn a blind eye to it. Or at least it begs the question of what would he have to do for you to say that it was on the table.
Right.
In other words, it was hand tying that didn't have to be done.
Right. And sadly, that metaphor for someone running down the street shooting an AK-47 isn't that far off. And they're certainly shooting from Apache helicopters more and more these days.
The story about what happened in Iraq with the helicopter attack on the house. The Iraqis who live there say these were all civilians, and the Pentagon then says no, there were four terrorists, one terrorist in training, and oh darn it, we got a couple of kids.
Right.
And you know what? When you try to do that sort of comparison mathematics, you lose.
Yep. I'm reading from Common Dreams article. Do you know that website?
Oh, very well, yes.
Okay. And they have an article about the recent upsurge in U.S. airstrikes and the rise in civilian deaths. And one segment of this article says, on Wednesday, 8 people, including 2 children, were killed when a U.S. helicopter opened fire on a group of Iraqis traveling to a U.S. detention center to greet a man who was being released from custody, Iraqi officials said.
How do you read that and not just go hoarse with the screaming, Preston?
Right.
You see, I mean, we who are actually trying to pay attention are actually under it's all, oh gosh, I don't want to sound like I'm crawling up on the cross, but it's a greater burden because we are assaulted with this stuff and we are paying attention. And we don't follow along with that story that I think you and I discussed ever so briefly last week that says, you know, conservatives are happier people because conservatives look away from everything.
Yeah, yeah. And I think we need our places for that screaming. I think that's where art is so critical, and music. The punk scene, I don't listen to it much anymore because it's just not my pace of music right now at this time in my life. But there's this band called Propagandhi, and they're from Canada, very well informed regarding neoliberal economic policies and war and injustice. Recently, they toured through Central America, and they do a lot of screaming, and there's a lot of anger. And listening to that, I think, was, you know, can be so therapeutic for us to have those releases like that.
Well, we do, and I get some of that therapy in my own right. I really should work on my guitar, so, you know, then I could at least call it, you know, performance art or something. But it helps me, and from what I hear from the folks who tune in, both live and via podcasts and archives, there's some benefit to it for us all, because there's in the midst of all the frustration, there's a great big bubbling scream inside a lot of us.
Yeah.
Who have seen what has been done to this country and by the people who are in power and what this country is doing to the rest of the world, and we know it's wrong because this isn't complicated stuff. This isn't nuanced stuff, Preston. This is real easy Matthew, Mark, and Luke 10. Even the, you know, for the fundamentalists, this is Ten Commandments stuff. Thou shalt not kill doesn't have a bunch of caveats.
Yeah.
And it doesn't say thou shalt not kill unless you are going to call it collateral damage.
Yep. You know, I'm so glad that this stuff is, you know, there's that alternative theology, though. I mean, we see the gospel, the social justice contained in it, but there are these other theologians like Rod Parsley who are reading the Bible very differently.
Well, see, this is where I become a bit intractable, Preston. I don't believe he's reading the Bible at all.
True.
He quotes it to his own ends.
Right.
And his own ends are whatever it says at the bottom line of his bank account every month. These people are, the Rod Parsleys and John Hagees and Dobsons and so forth of the world are bigger atheists than, well, frankly, they give atheists a bad name. Because I don't know a lot of mean atheists.
Yep.
But I know a lot of mean-spirited, right-wing, evangelical fundamentalists. You know, when Hagee is screaming, "If you won't get off your blessed assurance, then starve," at the top of his lungs, that tells me a lot about him. Especially when you see him doing it on the video, and you realize that he makes Orson Welles look anorexic, and he's going to tell somebody else to starve. No, can't cope with that.
Yep, you're right. You're right. You know, before I forget, as I was listening to Cindy and the way she's strategizing and the sort of activism and community connections she's making, I was thinking, I was wondering if they had anybody to document her efforts. There's so much good independent filmmaking going on, you know, people creating their own media when they can't bear to listen to.
I would be sincerely surprised if someone wasn't videoing and recording audio as this process goes along, especially the way she described that process, you know, going to BART stations and going to farmers markets and, you know, working the street corners and having people come into the office and so forth. That you're right, that begs for documentation, and Cindy has been around the block enough in the last 5 years that I imagine it is being documented. Frankly, I think for her own protection, it's probably being documented, because the other side will stop at nothing, Preston.
Yeah, protection, outreach, education, you know, save it, you know, create it for future generations to learn about the struggles. I came upon recently a DVD of Paul Wellstone's life, simply called Wellstone. And I think I found it at there's something like a Wellstone Action Committee or something like that. I was so glad I found this movie because, you know, I had a vague notion of what he was about. I remember being heartbroken when I was actually listening to a right-wing radio show at the time, a guy named Mike Rosen here in Denver, and he announced that a plane had gone down, and it looked like Senator Paul Wellstone was on that plane. And, you know, and I learned about him in snippets here and there, but this film really gave me a more intimate look at him and the work of him and his wife, his family, all sorts of people around him, the movement that they had created in Minnesota. Really inspiring stuff, really great. And it ends on this beautiful note of these young people at a Wellstone camp kind of practicing their own political lectures and stuff. It was really moving. But, yeah.
I didn't know that sort of thing was going on. That's what a beautiful tribute and beautiful memorial to who and what Paul Wellstone was in trying to raise another generation and to go and continue his work.
Yeah, in fact, I think a handful, maybe I want to say about half a dozen graduates of these Wellstone camps have been elected at, you know, smaller, you know, city council offices. And
well, that's where it has to start, isn't it?
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. You know, and I, at the same time, I admire what are called, you know, quixotic attempts at some other positions. You know, Nader wasn't going to win. Frederick Douglass wasn't going to win with his. He was in like a Freedom Party or something like that. I don't imagine Cindy will win, but still, in the process of making this run, there are these efforts to communicate and make connections, and those can develop into other sorts of projects, a different sort of politics. So.
And I understand what you say about Cindy's chances, but I, by the same token, Preston, I would think that if there's any place on earth that she has a chance, it's San Francisco. Now, I don't know enough about the demography of the districts in and around the Bay Area. I would guess that that 8th district with Nancy Pelosi in it must be a pretty tony place.
Yeah, yeah. And I imagine, I don't know what the voting, what the numbers are there, or what sort of Republican opposition there may be, but I wonder if she'll receive that, you know, that criticism that, you know, she may peel away enough votes from Pelosi to get a Republican elected. I don't know if that's the circumstance at all, but that's...
I would imagine someone will make it, but...
Yeah.
And I realize that I'm putting my own prejudices and my own, perhaps hypocrisies on display when I say this, but I see a dramatic difference between Cindy Sheehan running against Nancy Pelosi and Nader's presence in the 2000 election. Because, among other things, the scope of the electorate is so dramatically decreased into one congressional district I'm not trying to demean anything, that the stakes are wildly different.
Yeah, there are different circumstances for sure, and you know, we may have disagreements about whether or not that was the right strategy. It would have been interesting to see how someone like a Nader would do if he, say, ran for Senate in Connecticut. You know, he challenged Lieberman.
At the end of the day, that's sort of the essence of my gripe with Ralph Nader, is that he really could do significant good, but actively elected not to. Insofar as, you know, can you imagine Ralph Nader in the Senate? I can. I would think it would be a pretty pretty doggone dynamic affair.
Yeah.
Or in the House or in state government. Look at the path that Jerry Brown has traveled in California. Yeah, he's been governor of California. He was mayor of Oakland. Now he's the attorney general of California. He's run for president.
He was a radio host for a while.
He was a radio host. He's talking about running for governor again. And I respect Jerry Brown.
Me too. I think I voted for him, actually, a long time ago in the 90s. I think he was in primary.
That may have been the 92 primary. I think he was running when Bill Clinton ran.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. Well, we agree on that.
And I hope that, you know, I hope that, that Cindy is right and that she will serve also to empower other people to challenge.
Yeah.
From a political standpoint, it doesn't have to be an independent challenge. The one thing that most of these incumbents never imagine is that they will be challenged in their own primary and be challenged viably. And that's one of those places that where the progressive movement has got to still do a lot of growing up, and there are a lot of people trying to help along the way. A couple of Blue Dog Democrats have been gotten rid of in favor of progressive liberal Democrats who will run in the fall. Lady in Maryland comes to mind. I'm sorry, I can't come up with her name off the tip of my tongue, but there are others as well. And it's
Roy Carter in North Carolina.
Yeah, and it's a matter of realizing that. And a lot of this is like it's like a relationship breaking up, Preston, because you're sitting there so heartbroken when you realize that something you've devoted so much of your time to is antithetical to what you believe. I spend a lot of time feeling that way about the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't change what I'm going to do in November with a Democratic presidential nominee, but I'm not going to vote a straight ticket in November because... When I walk into the booth here in Fayette County, West Virginia, there are some people who are Democrats who are not going to get my vote because they have not earned it. And I've gotten to a place in my life where I'm not going to let politicians have what they don't earn. I'm not in the political charity business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand that. And
if it weren't for things like the Supreme Court and the urgency of trying to get out of Iraq, I might take the same tack on the presidential election. But we are in Iraq. We are facing a war against Iran. The president does choose not only the Supreme Court justices, but all of the federal judiciary. And as a result of that, I've got to do some nose holding and some I guess maybe hyper ugly realism where the presidency is concerned.
Yep. I tried different approaches, and like in 2004, I had voted for Nader. In 2000, Colorado was a safe state.
Right.
It became more of a toss-up in 2004. I voted for Kerry, although I sent money to Nader's campaign because I was glad he was out there running around talking about certain issues that weren't being talked about so much. And I saw him speak in Boulder that year, and it was such a contrast to 2000, because in 2000, you know, he was getting 10,000, 15,000 people at these stadiums. What Barack is doing this year is very exciting. I like to see the enthusiasm, but it's not unique. It has happened in the past, and it was a really threatening movement to people in power. Big business has been gunning for this man for 40 years. Lawsuits, surveillance, on and on and on. Defamation campaigns, endlessly.
And that's why I wish. That's why I wish he really. I remember the night that Bill Maher and Michael Moore together, and I think it was 2004, begged Ralph Nader to work to see John Kerry elected.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that. And he would be a formidable ally, not a formidable opponent, but a formidable ally, because I have never quarreled with his issues.
Mm-hmm.
I've quarreled with his tactics and his strategy.
Yeah.
And that's what drives me so crazy about it.
Yeah. And we can have these disagreements. And what drove me crazy was the way the arguments were so often framed. It became so divisive. And I mean, the way his supporters were being attacked when they were trying to get enough signatures for him to be on ballots in various states, his signature gatherers were being spat upon and just screamed at by people. How anti-democratic. If Republicans were doing that to us as Democrat liberals, we'd be furious. We'd have the ACLU on them. But I saw liberals doing this to progressives. And it wasn't just Democratic progressives. He did pull a fraction, a third or so, of Republicans to his various efforts.
And frankly, it's petty and small-minded of me, I freely admit. But I hope Bob Barr does the same thing to John McCain.
Yes.
Because it would be nice to see somebody else's ox get gored for a change.
Yeah, it goes that way sometimes. I mean, look at what who was the third party in '92? Ross Perot.
Yeah.
Got something like 20 million votes.
Oh, I have heard Rush Limbaugh scream himself blue in the face, Preston, screaming that, you know, my friends, Bill Clinton did not become the president of the United States by virtue of the majority of the voters in the United States. His presidency is illegitimate.
Right.
Because of the Perot vote.
Yep.
And to a certain extent, you have to at some point, no matter how partisan one's position is in the debate, one has to also address the issues that the candidate one supports creates.
Yeah, and it can be a toss-up. You know,
Al Gore's micromanaged campaign in 2000 was a textbook example of how not to.
Yeah, and his picking of Lieberman, it's as if it was chosen to prove Nader's point about there being Republicrats. And one of the arguments, one of the ways it always became such a battle was this, the line about there's no difference between the parties. And one side says, yes, there is, and the other side says, no, there isn't. And it's more...
Well, I think the last sort of 7.5 years have proven the point on the, yeah, there's a big difference.
I think it's one of those circumstances that's not either or. You know, it's both. It's yes and no. In some ways, there are stark differences.
Well, is there a difference, say, between Dianne Feinstein, who is so lobbied up that she can, that she probably has to fight her way out of her bedroom every morning to get through the lobbyists and the money people.
Her husband, isn't he a military contractor?
Humongous participant in the military industrial complex.
Okay.
Yeah, blood all over the place, frankly.
Yeah. But her versus.
Well, her versus any Republican. John McCain, for heaven's sakes.
Right.
That man's not going to have a campaign staff by the time he gets done having the lobbyists outed.
Right.
Between the lobbyists and the televangelists, I imagine, you know, there's every chance that by October, he'll be knocking on doors by himself. I kid. But there's a lot of truth in that. On the other hand, it's easy to say, well, yeah, okay, that's right, but she gets a lot of the other issues right. And then Dianne Feinstein comes along and lets telecom immunity out of committee, or was it habeas corpus? I forget. I'm sorry. I've got as a liberal Democrat, and I'm sure you feel the same way, Preston, I've got some doggone many knives sticking out of my back that I have to label them to see who put which where.
Right. Yeah. There's so much. It's impossible to keep track of it all. But yeah, on some other important issue, she wasn't being progressive.
She was barely being. Look, with that kind of stuff, the spying and domestic wiretapping and the telecom immunity and all of that stuff, there's only one right answer, and there's no discussion. You're either for the Constitution, you know, I'm sorry to get all George Bush on anybody, but you're for it, or you're either for the Constitution or you're against it.
Right.
And nuance is for dummies.
Mm-hmm. There's actually a line from the Bible, I think, Luke, that's kind of pulled from, you're either with me or against me or something.
Well, there's also that line in Revelation where John's hallucination of Jesus says, I would that ye were either hot or cold, but ye are neither hot nor cold, and for that I will spit you out of your mouth. You know, out of my mouth. So, you know, that's, you know, whether you're right or wrong, believe in something. Don't just sit there looking for the next chess move. Because sometimes action is required. The late great Bear Bryant had a slogan hanging on the locker room wall, and all it said was "Make something happen."
Yep.
And we're at one of those phases in our country, Preston. We got to make something happen. I mean, here you've got the Senate sort of trying to throw a bone, I guess, to say, well, you know, we're going to vote to pay some more money to blow some more brown people up, but hey, we're going to extend the unemployment benefits while we're at it. See? Meanwhile, Bush has said that he'll veto anything that isn't exactly what he wants, so make him veto it. The House, you know, the House, because of some Republican finagling and shenanigans, utterly rejected a new war funding bill. So this thing has to bounce back to the House now, I guess, where we have to see if the House will capitulate.
Yeah. And we were talking about McCain and the lobbyists around him, just to go back to an earlier topic, who will be with McCain, which lobbyists will have to kind of distance himself from, or because they've been representing tyrants or whatever. But one person that will always be there with him is Cindy McCain, you know, and she has quite a bit of money from the beer connection.
Oh, and you remind me of something here, too, because this was sent to me earlier in the day. I have a feeling Cindy's about to get a lot richer.
How so?
because there is a humongous Belgian brewing concern called InBev. Among other things, they produce Beck's beer.
Okay.
And they have reportedly been making friendly phone calls to August Bush the Fourth, saying, we'd like to buy your company.
Mm-hmm.
August Bush the Fourth. That would be Budweiser. This whole country is a fire sale right now because of what's been done to the dollar and the economy. And as a result of those rumors, Anheuser-Busch shares rose 7.7% or $4.03 to close at $56.61 after reaching as high as $58 earlier in the day when it had been, it was around $48.50 a share. You know, when you own an umpty bajillion shares of Anheuser-Busch and it goes from $50 to $56, you just got a lot richer.
You sure did. You sure did, definitely. And so thinking of that beer industry power and how it influences, it may influence our election, I was reminded of the beer activist. I think you interviewed him.
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Okay.
Great guy.
That wonderful book, the title alone is great, Fermenting Revolution.
Yeah.
How to Drink Beer and Save the World. He very much goes into the politics of the beer industry and the strict kind of hierarchical situation of the corporate breweries versus the kind of more cooperative or local craftspeople doing their beers in their communities, often working with farmers in the communities, or organic farmers in other parts of the world. And, we have Coors here in Colorado.
No, it's not Coors anymore now, Preston. It's Molson Coors.
Oh, sorry.
Now, did Molson buy Coors or did Coors buy Molson?
Good question. I forgot.
But that's emblematic of what's going on in that little niche market in this country. It's Molson Coors, and it is Miller Beer S.A. They're now owned by the largest brewer in South Africa.
Mm.
Budweiser stands to be absorbed by the Belgians, which in that case I think would be good because I'm not a Budweiser guy, and I love Belgian beer. But what in America isn't ripe for the taking right now?
Good question. They tried to take the governorship here in Colorado. Joe Coors ran for governor, and despite having the Coors twins cheering him on, he lost to Bill.
And that's some cheering too, I got to admit. He was on the Silver Bullet Express, wasn't he? And it ran into a wall.
Yeah, and again, so your listeners remember some of his political lineage. The Coors business gave the founding money for the Heritage Foundation about 20 years ago.
Yes, they did.
Yeah, which has had an enormous impact on the political consciousness in this country. They are regularly on C-SPAN, and I don't blame C-SPAN. I mean, these ideas should be out there.
Well, they should be out there if for no other reason than to be readily refuted, because,
yeah.
I mean, I've seen a lot of the stuff that comes out of the Heritage Foundation, and I was talking with Carolyn Kay at the beginning of the program about she said, you know, she was surprised along the way somewhere she saw someone listed as being a conservative scholar, and was taken aback by that because, you know, you're either a scholar or you're not. You're either in the pursuit. If you're in the knowledge business, you know, granted, you try to prove a theory or prove a hypothesis, but if it doesn't come out your way, you don't fudge the numbers till it does. Because the truest sense of that word truth, which is a terribly fluid thing, unfortunately, the clearest definition of truth is to be found within the scientific method. And when you set yourself out as, well, you know, he's a conservative scholar. Oh, he's a conservative movie reviewer. Oh, he's a conservative biologist. Then that tells you at the front end that these people are fundamentally dishonest.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think for an instant that the Heritage Foundation would ever release release their findings if their findings didn't support right-wing ideology? No, they send it back into the lab and fudge it up and dummy it up until it does.
Yeah, if it didn't support the profit interests of some industry or some market development project of some industry, it goes back. And, you know, a conservative scholar sounds much more impressive, authoritative than corporate PR agent.
Or right-wing ideologue.
Right, right. And
because that's what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
These aren't scholars. These are right-wing ideologues. And, yeah, I guess there are left-wing ideologues.
Yeah.
But most of the ones that I run across are willing to be wrong or argue what's wrong with the situation in order to make it right.
And they're not getting stacks of cash from major
No. If anybody gives money to a supposedly liberal or progressive organization, the money comes with so many strings it looks like a grass skirt.
Right.
And
right.
There's got to be, you know, what I jokingly refer to as a strict quarterly accounting for all the paper clips you've used.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I joke, but it's true.
Yes.
On the other hand, you know, whether it's Adolf Coors' progeny, or the Amundsens, or any number of the other. Oh golly, there's so many of them. They say, oh wait, what? You want to set up a think tank that's going to say that America exists for the good of the corporations? How much do you need? No. You say 10 million? Are you sure 10 million's enough? Let me give you 20.
Yeah.
And that's how. And meanwhile, we struggle along.
Just hire you a couple assistants.
Yeah.
You know?
And there are example after example on the left of that not happening, of the exact opposite of that happening, or left-wing organizations doing really dumb things. I will never forget the fact that MoveOn.org ponied up something like $450,000 for Robert Byrd's reelection, and he turned around and sunk a shiv in between their ribs with Sam Alito. And they didn't even have the nerve to say, you know, we don't appreciate this.
Yeah. And imagine what that kind of money could do for media projects like, of course, Head On, and so many others, you know, good community radio projects. And, you know, that's one thing, that's a point that Ed Schultz has been pushing, and I think it's been an important one, about how liberals just simply not using audio, not engaging the audio sphere.
Not me, not you. A whole bunch of liberals and progressives don't understand talk radio.
Yeah.
And I say talk radio because, you know, that's my little part of the niche that I occupy. But they don't understand it because they, among other things, have been poisoned against it by virtue of Rush Limbaugh and Michael Savage and that crowd, and they think that only idiots listen to it.
Yeah.
But they don't understand that it has a salutary domino effect, in that if it's done right, and by done right I mean not done like the right wing does it, then it empowers the people who share their time to participate in it, who then go out, because, yeah, you know, we talk about water cooler politics. Well, you know, you take a well-intentioned liberal who doesn't have anybody getting his back or her back, doesn't have any information support, doesn't have any anywhere to clear notions or clear ideas. The internet helps with some of that, but you know, you go to the water cooler and there's the guy who was listening to Savage last night, who can tell you how funny that Michael Savage was when he made fun of Ted Kennedy's brain tumor, and that therefore he has validation to laugh about Ted Kennedy's brain tumor too. I mean, does this make sense, Preston?
Oh, Hannity, when Kennedy was diagnosed, he chose to play some old tape that he's played 100 times before with Ted Kennedy getting angry with him, basically telling him, you know, hold on, Sean, wait a minute, you might, and he kind of stumbled over his words, but he's basically saying, you know, don't talk over me. I'm not going to let you talk over me. That's what Hannity chose to do, and they're just so crude. It's amazing. I, you know, before I forget, I wanted to say something actually fair towards the Coors family. I certainly disagree with their politics and heritage as crime. They're big backers of the Contras.
Don't like their beer either.
Don't. Their company, or their plant, one of their plants here, and they've been anti-union and anti-gay, long list, but one of their plants here, I know, hires former prisoners, and a lot of companies won't do that. And a friend of mine had gotten out of prison, and he was having a hell of a time trying to find a job, and he was hired on there. I almost got a job there myself years ago, and I toured their plant in Golden, and it's like something out of Charlie Chaplin's, what's that called, the time machine thing, you know?
Yeah, Modern Times.
Modern Times, yeah. And you have these incredibly long shifts, I mean, like 10 hours, 4 days, and just watching bottles fly by. You know, contrast that.
Yeah, it ain't exactly Laverne and Shirley at the Schatz Brewery.
It's something like that, but like 10 times faster and way, way bigger. And contrast that with, we've got two great local breweries here, like New Belgium. Totally different feel.
Oh, New Belgium. I've read so much about them.
Yeah, yeah. They're featured, actually, on this show on the Sundance Channel called Big Ideas for a Small Planet, with all their cool solar and wind and biomass energy projects, and their workers are advocates for their community at large. Like, they're part of an effort to save a river, the Poudre River in northern Colorado, from being dammed and diverted, and, you know, the habitats, the fish runs being destroyed and all that stuff. And they also have invested a lot of money, thousands and thousands of dollars, into progressive media, simply by running advertisements in, like, Mother Jones and the Progressive.
Ooh, I need to talk to them.
Yeah, yeah, I think they'd be interested in knowing what you're doing.
I could give them a whole new dimension of product placement, you know, in my refrigerator.
Yeah.
Cheap. No, I'm kidding. You know, you mentioned the Sundance Channel. I don't know if you were listening a couple of nights ago or not, but David Novak was on, the director of Burning the Future.
Yeah.
And his DVD comes out for sale next week.
Fantastic. I think I've already ordered one. I caught that when the Sundance Channel played that. You know, they do this Big Ideas for a Small Planet kind of like news segment for an hour, or news magazine maybe. And then they follow it with a documentary about environmental justice issues. And I saw that. Actually, that was the night of the West Virginia primary that they aired it. And I was kind of flicking back and forth between election coverage and this documentary. It was a strange contrast, for sure. The numbers and fancy graphics on these fancy news shows, and lots of trumpets and sound effects and so on and so forth, like an illusion in many ways, versus the real circumstances of people in West Virginia, their poverty and the job issues and their concerns about their children's health, real issues. And, you know, I think both Barack and Obama have done a good job of bringing up real issues and, again, avoiding that divisiveness and not letting us be diverted and hyper-focused upon the most contentious of things. You know, I think I might be misremembering who Ritter ran against for governor. He may have ran...
Pete Coors. Because Pete ran for Senate, and, I can't remember. I guess he's your junior senator from Colorado. Doggone.
Ken Salazar.
Yeah, Ken Salazar beat him. And then he ran for governor, didn't he? Or was it the other way around?
See, actually, there's a banker, I think, that Ritter ran against. Bob somebody.
Okay, so it was Pete Coors running against Ken Salazar for the Senate.
That's it.
And yeah, Pete always looks like such a nice guy when he's on the commercials, you know, sitting there with his hand in the rushing mountain stream. But, you know, I can tell that was filmed somewhere on a soundstage or something, because that would be some cold water and you'd be going, oh, cold. Yeah, but I'm being a smart aleck.
Yeah. Anyway, I guess lastly, I want to hear some of your other callers, but wanted to mention a book I found called Guerrilla Learning, how to something like how to continue your education, whether or not you're in school, and it's just a you know, with the cost of college, you know, that getting so out of reach for so many people, it's good to know that there are these alternative paths we can take to different sorts of learning. And I actually had some heard some people call in, working class people who were felt like they're kind of being dismissed as being labeled uneducated, you not having a college degree.
I know a lot of people who are really mad about that.
Yep, yep. And there's this really articulate guy called in and said, you know, there are different varieties of education, and you know, he brought up a machinist and, you know, the apprenticeship so many people do, or
I don't know how many people know outside of organized labor that the apprenticeship programs that most of the most of the trades go through are 4 and 5 year programs that by the time you're done, experientially speaking, are the equivalent of a college degree. I mean, there's schooling, there's tests, and you can't just sort of sleepwalk through it, because there's a lot, because this stuff's dangerous, you know. And I, for one, you know, I was fortunate to have a college education, and I had my parents to thank for it. And frankly, I've thought a lot, spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, how much did I learn there and how much did I learn outside. And at my age, I've got to say that the vast majority of the learning I did came outside the halls of academe, if you will.
Yep, yep.
And
people just pursuing their own interests. You know, forget college or any formal trainings or anything. Just their own curiosity often takes them, and there's so many amazing ways. And our people, you know, friends of mine I work with, who pretty much they've dedicated a lot of their time to sports fanaticism. But
and they're absolute experts at it.
Yes, the intelligence around that is amazing, the memories and the analysis and so on and so forth. And then their sense of humor, just their, I don't know, just how they can...
Well, I've got one of the guys that I went to law school with is one of the, you know, and I think he graduated first in our class. I mean, this guy was flipping genius. But and I guess he's still out there practicing, but he runs an online NFL commentary site, and I mean, you know, a lineman doesn't get his back waxed that he doesn't know about it, and he is a huge resource for NFL information, and I would only expect him to be that way because that was the same sort of determination that he brought to his studies. But I get a feeling he enjoys the heck out of his NFL stuff more than he does anything touching the practice of law. So it's all out there. I am going to run along, Preston. Got a couple of blinkies here. I don't know if people have stayed with it or not, but hope they did, and I hope you have a great Memorial Day weekend.
You too, definitely.
All right, take care, Preston.
Good night, Bob.
Bye now. Our buddy Preston in Denver. I love our conversations. Let's keep it rolling along. Oh, no, you quit. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hello.
Oh, I didn't hear the usual pussy sound.
Oh, okay. Well, it must have been there. Hi, Richard.
Yeah, it's Richard. Just outside of Richmond, California.
How you doing?
As a matter of fact, I know you got a caller from Richmond. I'd love to say hello to him.
We've got I don't know that he emails more than he calls.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, because he, we got several listeners in and around the area. We may be, I think Dave is in Richmond as well. Dave may be who you're thinking about.
You mean Dave in Northern California?
Yeah.
Well, he's way hundreds of miles north of me.
Oh, okay.
He's
so
Eureka.
Okay, yeah, he's in Eureka. No, the guy who's in Richmond is more of an emailer than a caller, but yeah.
Oh, really? I've heard him, and, you know, he'd love to say hello. Richmond is a pretty good-sized place. The population is about the same size as Berkeley's.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah, I didn't even know. I looked it up. Reason I'm calling, I have a fascinating issue that's got me really steamed.
Okay.
I just wanted to bring this up, which is political robocalls.
Oh, God, I hate him.
Liberal practice in general. Has anybody ever talked about that?
Not lately that I can... No, I don't think so.
Yeah, okay. Let me bring it up then. I hate robocalls. I don't like sales calls. You know, I want my telephone to be mine. And I hate to be interrupted by the telephone, you know, when it's nothing I want.
And see, a lot of people don't realize that political robocalls or even live human being political calls are not covered within the Do Not Call list.
What?
They're not covered by the Do Not Call list. Because they are deemed political speech.
Okay.
Back a couple of years ago when that monstrous SOB coal baron Don Blankenship was trying to accomplish some more of his nefarious goals in West Virginia, our phone rang probably every 15 minutes with a damned robocall that you can't do anything about.
Well, there's one thing you can do, and it may be quite effective, is you call whoever the robocall is made on behalf of, and you tell them, you just lost my vote.
Yeah.
Because calling me this way is really contemptuous of me.
Well, and see, I
showed me how little respect you're going to have for me if you're my representative.
And I extend that stuff to unsolicited mail mail as well, Richard. Case in point being the solicitation I received from the Clinton campaign. See, they deemed that every Democrat in West Virginia was just de facto Clinton vote. And so Agnes and I both got on the same day the very same solicitation letter from the Clinton campaign that contained a no postage necessary if mailed in the United States return envelope that said, Rush, return within 5 days, you know, where I was supposed to send Hillary Clinton money. Well, I didn't. I printed off a photograph of Surrender Dorothy from the web and wrote, you know, please knock it off. And you know, because, you know, I didn't think that was mean of me to do, because I think my time is worth the cost of a stamp. So since my time is worth the cost of a stamp, I charged her a stamp for the amount of time of mine that I'll never get back, that there's no, you know, finite stuff. I charged her the price of a stamp for wasting my time.
Yeah, that's good.
I'd do that with other political candidates too, that I don't support, who dare to waste my time by begging me for money when they don't even have any good reason to believe that I'm a supporter.
Well, the interesting part about the calls I get, the political robocalls, I'm a registered Democrat. I only get robocalls from Democrats.
Oh, yeah, that's because they buy the list.
Yeah, and I've called my congressman, you know, his office, George Miller, who's usually a good guy, right?
Yeah, he is. He's a decent Joe.
Yeah, and I said, look, I'm sick of these political robocalls. I want him to do something about it. Well, about a month ago, I got a robocall with his voice on it, and I just got a robocall today with him talking up a candidate for the legislature named Tony Thurmond. I got one from Tony Thurmond himself about a month ago, and I called his home and left a message on his answering machine. I said, don't ever use this again for me. And I gave him my phone number. I said, get me off your list. Well, I just got one. Now it's even compounded. George Miller's voice. You know, hustling for Tony Thurmond. And I just called, I left a very nasty message on Miller's answering machine.
Well, see, Richard, all of this is an outgrowth of the corruption of our political system. Because candidates are... the Republicans started it with people like, what was his name? I can't remember offhand. But in the late 60s, it started with a direct mail outfit. And oddly enough, the growth of the evangelical right-wing religion industry and the Republican Party via direct mail happened at the same time because they happened with the same guy. And when they saw the return on that, then the next thing, the next step is, you know, telephones, and then it's computers, and it's spam, and it's and it's all because our politicians can't find another way to reach us with a real, honest to God. It's a substitute for actually doing their job in many instances, Richard. At least that's my opinion.
In what way?
Well, if you're doing my business in the legislature or in whatever post that you're in, if you're doing your job right, then you don't need to tell me that you need me to vote for you, because I'm going to do it anyway.
Good point.
However, if you're sitting around with your thumb up your butt and going to booze and shrimp dinners that your lobbyist pals are hosting, then you're going to have to resort to that kind of stuff, because you might be afraid that I actually know what you're up to. And then I need some reinforcing. I need to be reminded what a demon the other guy is, for instance.
Well, on Miller's behalf, I'll say, you know, I've never gotten a call for Miller from anybody. But then again, he doesn't need it. I mean, he's very safe in his seat, I think.
Yeah. But look at so-called push polling and all of the stuff that goes on around the country.
Yeah.
Where you do negative, and it's not even supposed to be legal, but they do it. That's why it's called push polling, because they do it under the guise of being a poll. You know, as in, are you in favor of the fact that liberals eat babies? Please press one for no or two for yes, you godless communist.
Be hungry, Bob.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, yeah. With a little garlic and a little butter. Yeah.
Oh boy.
Yeah, fried baby. Mm. Well, you know, that's the way it is with us liberals. We had baby on toast for lunch, but never mind. But that's where it comes from. It comes from the fact that politicians, by virtue of the money involved in the process, can't afford to just sit back and do their jobs.
Yeah, that's serious. That's really serious. That's a whole topic in itself. But let me continue on this.
Please do.
Robocall business. Here in California, for any of you Californians listening, dig this. It's against the law to fail to release a telephone line. And if requested. And, of course, the reason for that is you might be having a heart attack. Right? Somebody just called you to sell you some insurance.
Yeah.
You need to be able to call 911, like, right away.
Right.
Well, these robocall machines don't release the line. You hang up, and they just keep at it. You pick up the phone again. Hey, they're still talking. They don't release your telephone until they're finished with their message.
And that's probably a contractual obligation.
Well, you know, you figure, I mean, if the person hangs up on you, they don't want to hear the rest of your message, right? So all these people are committing felonies in California. And, but of course, you can't request that they release the line because there's nobody to talk to.
Well, you've got the attorney, I was just talking about this with Preston, you've got the attorney general to get the job done, though, don't you? I mean, isn't Jerry Brown the attorney general?
He's Jerry Brown. I don't think he's... I don't think of him as a guy who really listens, you know. As a matter of fact, I called his office to complain about...
You're a technology guy, though, Richard. If you figured out some way to get a recorder going that could note the fact that you have closed the line and then pick it back up and it's still going, that's grounds for a criminal complaint.
Huh?
That's grounds for a criminal complaint.
Okay. I don't know if I can prove it. I'd have to log it. And
there are evidentiary rules for what are called recorded recollections. You log it, you record it, you go, and you...
Yeah, okay. We have...
And then worse comes to worse, they can actually pull the pin... The phone company can call the pin... pull the pin records and show that, yes, the call came in at that time.
Oh, okay. Let's see. As far as I know, many of these calls are made from out of state.
Oh, yes.
And I don't know how traceable they are. I don't have, what do you call it, caller ID. I refuse to do it because I was doing a project at the phone company when they floated that whole scam. It's just a way to make money out of something that doesn't cost them anything.
Sure.
You know? It's just
that's
like
the whole phone company, Richard.
Yep. I mean, it's just like text messaging on cell phones. They charge a premium fee for it. Text messaging is virtually free for them.
Long distance is free for them. Everything they do is free for them. They have the infrastructure in place. It's all money.
Yep.
I mean, good work if you can get it.
Robocall thing, I'm not done with that. We have this do not call list thing, right?
Right.
We have a new generation of people who found a way to get around that. And they call using robots instead of people. In other words, the same stuff that politicians are doing now. Now, the typical call goes like this. Hi, this is Joe. I got some really great siding for you at this killer price. If you're interested, if you want us, you want to talk with us, press 1.
Yeah. Oh, Richard, you're not telling me anything I don't know.
Now, of course, by doing that, they're not identifying themselves.
They're not identifying yourselves, and you are opting yourself into their program.
Well, you could do that. Yeah, you could say that, too. Of course, they usually say something like, to prevent further calls, press 2, you know.
Yeah, and that never works.
They're going to listen to the whole thing to get to that point. But you see, you cannot lodge a violation of the do not call list unless you know who called you and unless you know their telephone number. So they just killed it in two ways. One, they did not identify themselves. You can't put the government won't take a complaint because you can't tell them who it was who called you. The second thing is that you don't know their phone number because you're responding with a key push.
Yeah, because you're dialing them. Exactly. But you're not under the impression that the do not call list was designed as to help people, ordinary people, are you?
Well, actually, it's worked quite well for me until this new scam, which is being used both out of state and in state. There's no way to complain. So I called Jerry Brown's office. I said, hey, we got a problem here. He said, sorry, we can't help you. You can't identify the people who called you. I said, yeah, that's exactly the problem. And they said, well, you know, nothing. You know, we can't do anything.
Yeah, thanks for playing.
Yeah, thanks for playing. And, you know, we also have a state law against robo-sales calls, period. But it seems like Jerry Brown's office never heard of it.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, and I've called my representatives, my legislator,
But remember, violation of a criminal wrong often gives rise to a cause of action for a civil action. Just because you can't have them arrested doesn't mean you can't sue the bastards.
Good. I have an issue with my neighbor.
Oh.
My neighbor is deathly afraid of being robbed, and therefore floods my bedroom with light at night.
Oh, yeah.
One of those.
Well, because of the hours I keep.
We got to protect ourselves. Great, you know, the next time you interfere with my sleep, I'm just going to come over, you know, and break your light.
Yeah, because the light goes through your window, but it's not aimed at theirs.
Exactly.
No, fight fire with fire. Aim a light into his bedroom.
I can't. He's got curtains up, and I have to do it from his property because of the angles of the houses. But anyway, you know, yeah, I thought about the civil thing because, what's it called? Preventing the enjoyment of my home, I think is the way it goes.
Yeah, a nuisance.
Well, actually, the wording I've seen used is enjoyment of your home. But they're leaving. They're going to New York, and good riddance. But you don't need to listen to me talking about that.
They're going to New York to get away from the burglars? I mean, I'm just trying to get this straight here, Richard.
No, he's got himself a new job. He's a cancer researcher, and I think he's got a lot of money, and he's young, so he's
these people are too young to know what it's like to be a good neighbor and to be considerate of people you live around. And I had to read him the riot act about his car alarms when he first moved in.
Oh, those are fun.
You know, I don't want to know. I don't want to be alerted when you get in and out of your car. And that was our first interaction. But anyway, you don't want to know about my neighbor. I've just been, my topic this time has been the abuses of people's telephones.
But it's not the abuses of people's telephones, Richard. It's the abuses of people's lives.
Yeah, yeah.
Because okay. just like for all intents and purposes, I charged the Clinton campaign 42 cents for opening their stupid letter. The way I view my life, I would almost, I'd rather you steal just about anything from me than steal my time. Because most everything else can be replaced. My time can't.
Yes. The thing that really bugs me about, of course, you're talking about your time in reading their mail. I get this stuff from the Democratic Party. It says, Richard, you're so important to us. We've decided that to have you represent your whole area. And we want to know what's important to you. Give me a checklist of issues. And then, what are they going to do? They're going to send me more mail that says how much Hillary cares about these particular issues, right?
Yeah, exactly. Or any other politician. Hey, Richard, have a good Memorial Day weekend. I'm going to run along and close up shop here.
Okay, have a good weekend yourself and everybody else who's listening.
All right, well, take care. Good hearing from you.
Yeah, you too.
All right, bye now. I guess that qualifies me as a curmudgeon. But I don't like political yard signs. I don't like political phone calls. I don't like political direct mail. Because I try to be politically aware, and as such, they don't need to help. All this is predicated on the fact that you don't have the common good sense to decide for yourself who you want to vote for. Screw that. By the way, I mentioned Burning the Future in talking with Preston. There is a preview of Burning the Future that's on the main headonradionetwork.com blog. The story title is Clean Coal Exposed. So you might want to give that a watch. Let's a couple other things before we knock off for the evening. Let's see. Yeah, this will be big surprise. McCain aides lobbying firm is still being paid by foreign governments. Oh, how charming. This is Randy Schuneman that we mentioned a couple of nights ago. Yeah, they're still on the dole with the country of Georgia. So there's that. And here's an end of the night giggle. Sunday night at the St. Paul Saints ballpark is going to be a lot of fun. It's a giveaway night. There's a promotion. It's the bobblefoot giveaway. It is a depiction of a square stall, and you see two legs sticking out of the bottom of it. And when you move it, one of the toes taps. It has absolutely nothing to do with Larry Craig, however. The team is quite adamant in noting that. They say it doesn't matter if your tapping style is done with a wide stance or is used as some sort of code. We're celebrating National Tap Dance Day with a bobblefoot doll. I got a feeling some of those are going to be showing up on eBay, don't you? And just a quick follow-up, if you will, to what we me and that mouse in my pocket. Yeah. A follow-up to the Michael Savage stuff that we talked about a couple of nights ago. Where he played a song by the Dead Kennedys called California Uber Alles to celebrate the brain tumor that Ted Kennedy has. Classy guy, that Savage Wiener. And I said at the time, maybe I'm wrong, but I'm thinking he doesn't get
the idea of punk or the idea of satire or the idea that, or what was being poked fun at in that song. Well, it turns out I might have been fairly close on. A publication called The Phoenix chased down Jello Biafra, who was, of course, the front man for the Dead Kennedys. And he said the following, and there are some fun words in here, so little Johnny, little Timmy, little Susie, little Cindy, little Tammy need to be hustled out of the room. He said, I haven't read the details yet, but I'm aware of what Michael Savage did. Jello Biafra, by the way, is an incredibly intelligent human being who is more than vocal in dealing with right-wing rat bastards. He says, I haven't read the details yet, but I'm aware of what Michael Savage did. Obviously, he took my song way the hell out of context. Oh, look, Bob was right. And did it deliberately. But the bigger issue, and this is the real pay attention part of the program, but the bigger issue is Savage himself and how the hell he gets away with stuff like saying this and saying that people with AIDS should be put in concentration camps, and then when people protest at the station, he calls on his own listeners to come down and beat them up. Jello Biafra also said, it scares the shit out of me that the most popular radio talk show hosts are all foaming at the mouth, ultra-bigoted blabbermongers who only North Korea or the Nazis could love. And, of course, he is in large part right, with a few very minor exceptions. Or not minor exceptions, but a minority of exceptions. People like Mike, people like Tom Hartman. But like it or not, Savage is the third most popular radio talk show host in this country behind Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity. Nobody from the other side is represented or promoted well enough by the big right-wing-owned radio networks to compete. That's one of the ways they mindfuck the country into being so dumb they vote for people like George Bush, Mitt Romney, and Arnold Schwarzenegger. That bears reiteration. Nobody from the other side is represented or promoted well enough by the big right-wing-owned radio networks. Truer words have never been spoken. That is why we are here, the Horn. The real issue, he says, is why aren't the big candidates calling for media reform? Once upon a time, there was a law in the books called the Fairness Doctrine, and it said that if somebody like Savage or Limbaugh or that skull woman Ann Coulter said something completely fucked up and dishonest on the air, somebody else was allowed to come on the air and reply to them without being told to shut up every 15 seconds by a power clown like Bill O'Reilly. That law was on the books for 50 years, but was allowed to expire in the late 80s, when a Democratic-controlled Congress failed to override President Reagan's veto of the law. The damage was further compounded when your friend and mine, Bill Clinton, rammed through the Telecommunications Act of 1995, further deregulating how many radio stations and media outlets one corporation can own and what they can do with them, and they green-lighted their long-held agenda to throw public interest out of the window. And the volume and impact of the Rush Limbaughs and Michael Savages multiplied exponentially with nobody on the other side being allowed to reply. In large areas of rural and small-town America, this is the only radio anyone is exposed to. That's the problem. We need to bring back the Fairness Doctrine. John Kerry had a golden opportunity to fire back at the Swiftboat liars and use that as a platform to rally the public to demand media reform. But true to form, he was too chicken shit to do it. You know what's particularly lovely about that little diatribe? There's nothing offensive in that. The words, the way he uses them, aren't offensive or obscene. That thing is, you know, a couple of hundred words of pure, unmitigated truth. And could not be said on any terrestrial radio station in the country. Truth is not allowed on terrestrial radio in the United States. Oh, you've got to watch your language. Mildred, write to the FCC right now. I just heard him say chicken shit. Never mind all the factual, all the profoundly philosophically correct information around it. The only thing Mildred heard was that. And that's the sum, substance, and content of it. Now, we can have a philosophical debate about whether one should use those words or not, or, you know, and maybe we will, but not right now. Because the bottom line on all of this is that facts and truth and some semblance of honesty have been run off the airwaves. I admire the verve and the guts of the liberals who still try to work within the terrestrial radio framework. God knows they are running with a foot in a bucket uphill. Liberal radio gets put on flickering candle flame 5,000 watt AMs while, you know, Hannity, Limbaugh, and the rest of the filth crowd get on 50,000 watt blow torches. And then with the playing field, vertical like that, the right wing says, see, liberal radio can't succeed, even though liberal radio does succeed and has succeeded time and time again. The Malloys, Hartman, Randy, Stephanie, the people who are still trying to do terrestrial radio from a liberal perspective have my admiration. I don't know if I'd have the patience for it. Because there's this fluid list that never seems to settle down. Can I say this? Yes, you can, but you can't say it before 9 p.m. and only on a day that ends in Z. How the hell are you supposed to know whether you're going to have a job from one day to the next? It's madness. A couple of quick wrap-up things just to let you know. Big news. On Tuesday evening at about 6 p.m. Eastern Time, top of the show, I'll be joined for an in-depth conversation by former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. If you want to learn in advance about the depth and the depravity of what was done to him, I strongly encourage you to go to donsiegelman.org. That's S-I-E-G-E-L-M-A-N, donsiegelman.org. Look for this to be a whale of a conversation. We've also got coming up next week David Sirota, in advance of his new book. I think it's going to be a good week of conversation radio. But I'm especially excited about Tuesday evening talking to Governor Siegelman. Just an update. We are still a long, long, long way. We got over the $1,000 hump for halfway to our monthly goal. We did that a couple of days ago. But we are a long, long way from reaching the $2,000 that it takes to keep us going every month. If you haven't become a contributor to the Horn and you value the Horn programming and you are able to do so, please know we would sincerely appreciate it. I hope you all have a wonderful Memorial Day weekend, and I'll be quite candid. I don't know if I'm going to come on the air Monday evening or not. May take the day off or may not. Odds are, I probably won't take the day off because this microphone is where I'm supposed to be if it's a Monday through Friday and the hours are between 6 and 9 p.m. So I'll probably be here. Check in, just on the odd chance. Thanks to everybody for a great week of liberal conversation radio. Thanks to our mods in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, our bloggers. Thanks to you for taking time to share your time to participate in this little exercise in conversation and a restoration of the American dialogue, the American discussion, the American debate. Thank you to our contributors who do, in fact, keep the lights on. As long as y'all do that, we'll be here.